and welcome to episode 26 of the Zombie Girls podcast. With me today as my lovely co-hosts are Ariel.
Hi.
Sarah.
Hello.
And of course, the fabulous, the international, the mysterious, Exploding Joe.
Mysterious. Okay. Hi.
Moment of mystery. She may actually be a spy. I don't know, but I hope. Anywho, so what are we up to today? We're going to be talking a little bit about another one of our favorite female characters in genre. I don't know if you would strictly call it horror. Clarice Starling, who was in Silence of the Lambs, a little unknown film called Silence of the Lambs,
so
and
unknown.
Its vastly superior sequel. Which I can't say without a laugh. But before we get into tearing that apart, cannibalistically, I would hope, I wanted to see how everybody's doing and what you've all been watching and just play catch up. Sound good?
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
All right. Who'd like to start?
I'll start. I've got a fairly long list of things that I've been watching, so I don't mind starting.
Okay, all right.
Go for it.
I think I mentioned to you girls already, I watched Love Object.
I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah, this is a very old Zombie Girls recommendation from, like, I don't know, your second or third episode or something, long way back. And it was really good. I really enjoyed it. It reminded me a lot of Lars and the Real Girl, which I just watched recently as well, because I've been on a Ryan Gosling kind of thing lately. So similar sort of thing. But in that movie, he's completely, what's the word, abstinent, celibate, and this is kind of the opposite. But yeah, it was really good. I really enjoyed it. I really like, what's the actor's name? Quinn from Dexter. I forget his name.
Yeah, I just call him Quinn.
Yeah. He was really good, and the girl was really good. So that's a definite recommendation if people remember that movie from your show. Another one I saw was The Addiction, which is a vampire movie from the 90s, which kind of compares vampirism to a drug addiction. So it's kind of an interesting idea, quite an interesting analogy, but I didn't really like the film that much. It was a bit ponderous and
lame.
A bit slow and a bit... It was kind of like... It was quite philosophical, and I guess if it's fairly interesting in some ways, but I just didn't think it was that entertaining a movie, really. But it had some good people in it. It's got Christopher Walken for about 5 minutes in the middle, even though he's billed as, like, the second main star.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
I love that.
And... Lily Taylor, I think her name is. She was in the remake of The Haunting, and she was in an X-Files episode and some other horror things. She's pretty good. I quite like her, but the movie I don't think was that great. Let me see. I also saw for the first time Sleepaway Camp.
Oh.
How'd you like it?
I loved it.
Good.
Did you know the twist?
Yeah, I totally knew about the twist, which is a real shame because I heard about it on... I think it might have been the rise and fall of the slasher genre documentary, Going to Pieces. And I won't say what movie they compared it to, but you probably know, but that spoiled both movies for me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because they said, oh, yeah, it's just like the movie, the ending of blank, blank, blank movie. And I'm like, oh, I hadn't seen that either. And now you've spoiled both of them, but never mind.
Good times.
Yeah, I mean, they're both fairly well-known twists, so it maybe I should have expected it. But I was proud that I'd gotten so far in life without knowing... But it also reminded me in some ways of Halloween 4, in that it's not really a great movie overall until the last 5 minutes, and then it's like wow, except for the rest of the movie. So that was pretty awesome. What else have I got here?
The official fourth Sleepaway Camp 4 is actually coming out on DVD. I think it's already out.
Mm-mm.
I think it came out last week.
Right.
But,
Is it
pretty
good? Or?
You know what that means.
Basically, there was, like, they filmed a bunch of footage during the 90s, and I guess, like, production fell through and everything just went all horrible on this project. So, like, for the past, like, 15 years, somebody's been trying to, like, get this thing into a coherent movie, and apparently they have. So, we'll see.
Right. Oh my god, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's
I think we may
cool.
We may have a Sleepaway Camp retrospective coming up then.
That'd be fun.
Sounds like a plan. Those movies.
No, I like Joey. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
Not ready for that yet.
You guys go ahead. Well, I haven't seen any of the sequels yet. I don't know if they're meant to be any good, but there was one kill in the movie that I really didn't understand until I looked on Wikipedia. It's the curling iron or hair straightener kill.
Oh.
And apparently she gets stabbed in the vagina with her curling iron. And I thought, really? That didn't come across in the movie at all. But maybe I watched a cut version, but I don't know.
You're saying that's not how you do it?
Well,
I think I've been doing something.
That's not how we do it. And that just, I mean, that just didn't come across to me that that was how she was being killed. But anyway. What else have I got? I watched a German movie called Das Experiment, which it was really good. And I actually watched the remake first, not really knowing that it was a remake, which was just The Experiment with Adrian Brody and Forest Whitaker. And that was really, really good. And then I was intrigued to see the original when I heard that it was in fact a remake. I think I might prefer the American version though in some ways.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just because I saw that one first, but I don't know. I mean, the American version is pretty close to the German version, but I don't know how close either of them are to what actually happened in the 70s in the Stanford Prison Experiment. So I don't know how accurate any of them are, but because I think the German one is based on the book that was then based on the experiment. So, you know, things might have changed quite a bit, but but it was really good. And because the German one had you saw quite a lot of the background and you saw quite a lot of the scientists that were involved, and that really wasn't as interesting to me. But in the American version, you only see the prisoners and, you know, the participants in the experiment, and the scientists are kind of this unseen force sort of behind a camera that you never see. I just thought that was much more interesting, really.
Right.
But both movies I thought were worth a watch.
Awesome.
Yeah. I don't want to spend too much longer on it, but I saw Megan Is Missing. Chris and I talked about it at length on an Explodey file that's coming up, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But yeah, I definitely agree with what Sarah said when you said it was a punch to the gut. I can definitely get that. Yeah. Did Rachel brave that movie yet?
I haven't seen it yet. I was were saying that I could handle it, but only if I was ready to be very depressed.
Come on, chicken.
What's that?
Come on, chicken.
Oh,
and a chicken.
Oh, I was like, is that from the movie?
No, Sarah's reading you.
No, I'm gonna. You know what? Here's the thing: is I think what we have to do is we have to just decide that we're gonna do it as an episode, and then I'm just gonna have to suck it up.
Force you to watch it.
Yeah. Ariel, will you hold my hand for the sheriff?
We will tape your eyelids
will
open.
Will you dab the tears away from my eyes?
I think it depends how much you care about the characters. I mean, because personally, I quite, you know, cared about the two girls that are in the movie, so it kind of hit hard when you see what happens to them. But I can see how if you didn't care about them and you weren't really into the movie, that it really wouldn't have that much effect on you. But I would put it up there with, I'd say something like The Poughkeepsie Tapes meets The Girl Next Door. The Jack Ketchum.
Oh wow!
But it's not as what's the word? It's not as visceral as either of those two movies. But I think it was more effective than each of them in its own way.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. And the final one that I wanted to mention was going to be my love film pick. So I can leave that till the end if you want, or I can do that now.
Awesome. Let's leave it till the end.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Cool. All right. Well, who wants to go next?
I'll go ahead and go.
All right. Sleepy All right. Sarah.
Yeah. So, let's see. I recently saw Blood Creek for the first time. It was interesting.
Is that the weird Nazi one?
Yeah, Nazis in a West Virginia farm.
Right. Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it. How was it?
It's got a really cool concept to it, and it was done fairly well. I enjoyed it. It was good. It was a little gory, and the ending leaves it open to sequels, but hopefully they won't go that route.
The audience isn't exactly clamoring for Blood Creek 2. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it leaves it open for a sequel, but it doesn't need one. It's fine ending where it did.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Right. Let's see. And I saw Strigoi.
Oh, how was that?
That's like, you know,
weird, like it, Polish movie, right?
Yeah, it's a Romanian.
Romanian.
Yeah.
Strigoi.
Strigoi.
It's like the most fun word in the world.
It is.
Such a geek.
Oh no, I can't help it.
The movie itself is kind of a little sleeper. It's just, It killed time on a Sunday, but I wouldn't say it was phenomenal or anything. And I know it was kind of billed as a comedy.
Right.
But it's not, like, laugh-out-loud funny. It's kind of, like, humorous little things that make you chuckle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pass.
I think it's one of those ones. If you are bored on a Sunday, go ahead and watch it, and it'll kill some time. But it wasn't, like, phenomenal or anything.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
One that actually is really good is that I saw is called Otis.
I don't think I've heard of that. I think I've heard about this. Is this the vamp? This is like a zombie movie, right?
No. This is about a guy who's kind of he's kind of slow. He's this big lunky guy. He's kind of slow. His brother's always taking care of him, but turns out he's a serial killer, and he kills these teenage girls after putting them through this torture thing where he, like, relives his brother's high school years in the 80s.
Weird.
He calls their parents and he's like, hey, you know, Kim and I are dating now, and I just want to let you know that, you know, after prom, I'm going to totally fuck her. And, you know, he's like, but it's got Daniel Stern and Elena Douglas in it.
Awesome.
And, it's also got Kevin Pollak. He plays the brother of Otis. And what happens is Daniel Stern and Alina Douglas play a husband and wife whose daughter gets taken by Otis. And I don't know if you know who Jer Burns is. He's a comedic actor, and he always plays the jerk. But he just plays this jackass FBI agent who, you know, it's like every time they get a phone call, he's like, oh, yeah, he's raping her. I can tell. I can tell by the tone of voice he's using, you know.
And just, tone of voice.
You know, she's going to be dead soon, you know.
Oh, and, yeah, I know
this. Yeah, so basically the parents take matters into their own hand once they find out who Otis is. And it's a comedy. It's funny. It makes you laugh. And it's like, even the scenes with
like
Otis.
Like a rape and murder.
I got a funny bone.
Well, the scenes with Otis torturing his victim are just so absurd that you find yourself cracking up the entire time. Like he one scene, he like has this date with her and he's got this movie screen projecting this road and he's got a hollowed out Camaro that's like was his brother's in high school, and they're blaring a Flock of Seagulls. And it's just like that one was really good. One you need to totally avoid.
Okay.
Absolutely, positively avoid is a movie called October Moon.
Oh God, that was bad.
You heard that?
Yeah.
Consensus. Yeah. No. This came up as like a recommend for like a couple of like decent slasher flicks, and it's, you know, you've probably seen it, Rachel, how there's like that whole like genre of like gay horror, but it's mainly like a bunch of guys running around as eye candy.
Right.
Like, you know, like Vampire Boys.
Right. I totally know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. This.
And lots of it on Netflix.
This would be better if this was that. Instead, it's a story about a guy who's a closeted gay. He's got a girlfriend named Marty who wears tie dye and cut off shorts and
hot.
Ends up falling in love with his boss, who's a gay dude, and gets obsessive and kills him.
Okay, that's what I do when I fall in love.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just like, I mean, but the acting is horrible. The plot is horrible. It's awful. I mean, you can't even, like, make it into a drinking game. It's that bad.
Oh, wow.
Sounds awful.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah, and there's a sequel to it called November Sun. So,
oh, no. That's really bad. Did we just lose everybody?
Oh, no.
No.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Okay. So yeah, those are my picks, and that's not even my Netflix instant stay away from pick.
Okay.
Damn. Damn.
There's one worse than that. That's really saying something.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But Jody, I know you'll appreciate this. I saw Conan the Barbarian recently, the 2011.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet.
Well, you should.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, other than, you know, just the eye candy, it's actually a pretty decent movie. I know it got a lot of flack, but I actually think I like it better than the original Arnold one.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Boom.
Yeah.
Sarah's dropping some knowledge today. That's awesome. I agree with you, though. I actually really... I mean, it is what it is, you know? Like, you don't go into a Conan the Barbarian movie expecting Game of Thrones. But I just think... I love that movie. It was, like, gory and... ridiculous.
And he's such a rogue. He's just so, like... You know, like the scenes in the pub where he's just like, yep, that one's mine, and he just takes the girl. You know?
Sarah, was there a little wish fulfillment there for you?
I've actually done that.
Oh,
just
again,
walked,
boom.
Just like, you know, thrown a girl over my shoulder and left the bar.
That's pretty hot. I'm not mad at that. The finger up the nose. I mean, obviously, we're back to Conan right now. Nose scene is so brutal.
Yeah. Oh, dude, that is awesome.
I was just like, ooh, amazing, ooh, amazing, ooh. Yeah, Jody, you gotta check that out. I think
it's a
guilty pleasure in the making.
Yeah, I just rewatched the original not long ago, and it didn't really hold up to my memories of how awesome it was. But maybe I'm thinking of the second one, Conan the Destroyer. Maybe I'm thinking of that in my memory.
Is that the one with, what's her name?
Grace Jones.
Grace Jones. I came up with Grace Kelly, and I knew that one.
I always get the plot for Conan the Destroyer and Red Sonja mixed up, because they're kind of the same movie.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, I dated a guy who was, like, obsessed with those movies, so I think I've seen them all, like, 15 times.
My favorite is Conan the Librarian.
See, I always like Thundar the Barbarian.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So, Miss Ariel, you want to go next?
Sure.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Sarah. Were you still going? I just totally...
No, I'm good.
Okay.
I think I might need to top off my coffee, because all of a sudden I feel like I'm powering down.
Because for a minute there you were like, jitters. Yeah. All right. So I finally got around to watching Hobo with a Shotgun, which was interesting. It was really, really gory, and the way it was filmed, you know, sort of grindhouse style, was really cool. But I don't know, parts of it I found a little bit hard to watch. Like
the gore, or because of just
like the bum fight sucky stuff was kind of just a little difficult. But I mean, the characters, like the bad guys, were so over the top, ridiculous caricatures that it was a lot of fun, but super, super gory.
See, I just found that movie really obnoxious. And
I can see that.
Yeah, it got to a point that it's like, okay, just hurry up and take your revenge already.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Skip to the end.
Yeah.
That might be the theme of tonight. Skip to the end.
I mean, like, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. But, like, some of the kills were just really... Yeah, they were just so ridiculous and entertaining. Like, where they put the manhole cover around a guy's neck and shove him down the manhole, and then they like drive over him so his head like gets
that
lopped
sounds
off.
Awesome.
There's stuff like that that's just ridiculous and therefore entertaining.
Well, let me ask you, okay, like Machete I enjoyed for what it was, but I felt like it really felt padded. Like all the best ideas were in that trailer. Like it was made for a trailer. It was so campy and ridiculous that like that's the perfect medium for it. Was that the same with Hobo with a Shotgun? Did it feel like...
Yeah, I mean, I think like both of those movies, I would have maybe wanted a little bit more than just a trailer, but like a 20-30 minute short would have been probably just perfect, you know.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever see Treevenge? which made by the same guy. It's a short movie.
No, I haven't.
It's wicked. It's a short movie about killer Christmas trees. It's so good. I think it's on YouTube.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Is it like a little 20, 30 minute kind of thing?
It's shorter than that. I think it's only about sort of maybe 15 minutes.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect example of why, like, sometimes those little shorter, things are just better for a shorter medium. Like, Rubber mm-hmm. was fun for, like, the first 15 minutes.
Right, and then you're kind of, like,
yeah. You're just like, oh my, really? This is continuing?
It's
really?
Still happening?
We've already seen all the good parts in the trailer. What is going on?
I mean, the best part about Rubber was the exploding bunny.
Exploding. Yeah. I don't know. I kind of enjoyed the whole thing where the maid discovered the tire in the
right
in the shower. Like,
yeah,
the whole,
that
like,
was
sort of like
entertaining.
Psycho moment with that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Like,
there were some good.
The trailer was perfect.
Yeah.
It was perfect.
Yeah. I saw Woman in Black in the theater.
Oh, I wanted to miss that. How was that?
It wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be.
Oh,
I had
no.
really, like, I think my expectations were a little too high, maybe. I mean, the atmosphere of the movie was really cool. I thought Daniel Radcliffe did a very good job acting. He didn't seem like a little kid, because he was definitely supposed to be, you know, grown up. And he was believable in the role. And like I said, the atmosphere and the whole, color scheme of the movie was cool. But I just didn't find it... creepy enough.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Enough.
Yeah,
like, go on, were you gonna say something?
Oh, I was just gonna say, it felt like if you've seen any other horror movie in your life, then you'll anticipate every single scare and every
exactly.
single moment.
Like,
and...
I knew exactly what was coming each step of the way. They didn't really do anything new, and like, even when they had opportunities to kind of do something that was cool, they didn't really do it. Like, there's in the house, it's, you know, haunted stuff is happening. I felt like you kept seeing this like ghost woman and this other stuff, and it wasn't scary. She was just like there all the time. I don't know. And in the kids' room, there were like really fucking creepy toys, like old toys, wind up toys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted them to do more with that because they were just really creepy.
They were
but
really
maybe
creepy.
That's because I get creeped out by old toys like that.
They were creepy. And one thing that one thing that bugs me completely about the movie was, you know, the whole rush towards the camera screaming thing was just overdone so much. It would have been better if it was more in the background, you know, but
yeah, agreed. Definitely.
Yeah.
Bummer.
So, yeah, I was disappointed by that. But everybody else in the theater seemed to think it was, like, the best movie ever made.
Maybe
so.
We're just, like, jaded horror fans. Like, we've seen so much.
Yeah.
Like, those things to them are, like, fresh.
But
we're like, been there,
but,
that.
Like, my little sister came with me to the movie. And, like, I was telling you, she's not a big horror fan. She doesn't really watch horror movies. And she thought the movie kind of sucked, too.
Oh,
so,
okay.
And was predictable. Even though she doesn't watch... like any horror movies, really.
Bummer.
So
does that give you hope for the whole like return of Hammer horror?
That would be nice.
Well, I mean, that's what this was supposed to be, right?
Yeah.
Well, this and there was like some other thing that wasn't that great. Wasn't there like The Resident or something was a Hammer?
Didn't they do?
I thought it was.
I saw that.
What's that one with Jean Grey where she's in the house? Is it 100 feet or something? She's got like one of those electronic tags on her feet and she can't leave, but then there's a ghost in her house.
Was that Hammer?
I thought it was.
I actually, with the exception of the weird, like, Lifetime movie ending, I thought that movie was pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't mind it. The CG got to me quite a bit.
But how about the ghost killing that dude?
That's pretty that's pretty awesome.
Like, the teeth, like, flying out of his mouth.
Yeah,
like, you just see this ghost beat this guy to death.
Uh-huh.
But you can't see the ghost, so you just see his face, like, distorting, getting smashed against the... fireplace. It's pretty, that part is pretty fucking awesome, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, in Women in Black, you can see, like, the inspiration. I mean, there's the whole, like, they come into this town and everybody wants him to leave and they know something is going on. And that's very reminiscent of, like, you know, the old Hammer, like, vampire movies and stuff like that, where people, you know, out of towners would come into a little town and everybody's, like, either super religious and knows that there's a vampire and wants them to leave because they're afraid they're going to bring something on. So, I mean, that part of it was cool, but again, it just wasn't a good movie.
Mm. By vampire, do you mean Strugoi?
Yes! Exactly.
It makes you use that word.
So I finally saw the Fright Night remake, and
oh.
Rachel knows that I adore the original Fright yes. Night. That's like one of my favorite movies. And I actually, like, I enjoyed the remake, but
Here we go.
I didn't like it as much as the original.
All right.
Yeah. I just, I don't know. I mean, the magician guy or whatever was like, he was really entertaining.
He starts like taking everything
yeah.
off.
Yeah, that was hilarious. yeah, so he was good, but like, I wanted more out of the guy's best friend.
More Evil Ed. That was yeah. my one complaint about that movie, is they did not use enough of McLovin. McLovin yeah. should have been way more in that movie.
Exactly. Anyways, it was a good movie, and I had a lot of fun watching it, don't get me wrong. There was something I missed from the original.
What did you think about a Colin What's-His-Butt as the vampire?
I thought that worked okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you?
I liked it. Yeah. I don't have an attachment to the original, though. Like, I mean, I saw it, I liked it, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have the same kind of, I don't have the same kind of reverence for it that a lot of people do.
I think maybe I just saw it at like a perfect time in mm-hmm. my childhood or something, where it just worked on every level for me right. at that point.
See, I really like the first one, the original, yeah. but going back and looking at it now, I have a hard time seeing Prince Humperdinck as the sexy yeah. vampire.
Yeah, no kidding.
So like that scene in the club where he's you know, seducing right. The girlfriend, it's hard to watch, because it's just like, neither, he just doesn't have sexy charm that yeah. that Colin, whatever his name does.
Farrell, right?
Farrell? Yeah, yeah.
Farrell, yeah.
Okay. I'm like, no, that ain't right.
And I think I missed like Roddy McDowell too. I mean, I know that sounds sort of weird, but like the whole him having his late night horror show, like I wanted to be able to watch that as a kid. Like mm-hmm. his show, I thought that was so cool. And so having him be in the movie and then, you know, pulling on his knowledge from horror movies was really entertaining to me when right. I was younger.
Well, I think that also you have such like a love of like those kind of those anthology films
yeah.
where he would be the host of it. You know what yeah. I mean? Like so there's like that emotional tie to that type of character.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Definitely.
That's right. I just went deep with it. What are you going to do?
Okay, well, since we're talking about Hammer Horror, I saw Nightmare. I have this like Hammer Horror collection, and I've kind of been like going through them slowly. And Nightmare is actually really cool. It's not a monster movie. But it's have you guys seen Gaslight? Like the old Gaslight movies? There's like two of them.
No.
Okay. You just burst my bubble there.
I mean, yes, they're excellent films. I wrote a paper on them. I'm very familiar with the
All right, well, if you property. Haven't seen Gaslight, both of them are really awesome. Even, you know, they're old movies, but they're really good. And so Nightmare basically is like this girl who something happens in her childhood where her mother basically murders her father, and she's sent away to a boarding school. And you're not sure if her what's up with her mother. You kind of find out that she is in a mental institution. Anyways, the girl is having all these horrible nightmares, and she ends up going back home, where she has this like uncle and a caretaker and things like that, people that are sort of taking care of her in this house. And the whole time you're not sure is if she's going crazy and is going to turn into her mother and murder people, or are people driving her crazy, which is sort of the theme of Gaslight too. Mm-hmm. And it was done really well, and it was very entertaining. So if you can find a copy, I would recommend watching it.
Awesome.
Cause it's a little bit different than what I think most people think of when they think of Hammer. So, okay, now on to bad movies. Okay. So I watched Walled In on Netflix.
Oh. Okay. Friends don't let friends Netflix alone, apparently.
I was telling, like, I have, I don't know if you guys know this, but I have this problem of like, I have like, I hoard movies in my queue, like the good ones, and then I end up watching total crap.
I do the same thing.
The movies expire, and then you're like ass out.
I've actually had that happen a couple times. I wasn't going to admit that, but you kept staring me down.
My fierce gaze. You cannot resist the panda gaze. Hold on, let me put on my hood.
No, I'm serious. You guys haven't been with Rachel in person, but she has the uncanny ability of making everybody around her tell the truth about
shit. It's the truth lasso.
They never want to talk about.
I have the truth lasso. I do.
Like, you know, your most embarrassing sexual experience.
I once got a friend
that you never told anybody. She will get you to tell, and at a party in front of everyone else.
I once got a friend's husband to admit that he like visited a Costa Rican whorehouse. And I was one of those things where everybody had wondered because they knew he was like possibly participating in sex tourism. I just asked.
I know you say that. You always say, well, I just ask when nobody else would. But I swear if I asked, I would not you get the same response.
Well, no, it's nobody asks. Everyone wants to be polite. I just ask. I'm just like socially retarded. I just ask.
Oh my God. Okay, anyways, so Walden with Misha Barton. Yay! I don't know why I decided to watch this movie. It seemed like maybe it had a cool premise or something, where she's like this architect or there's this famous architect and he built this like crazy big house apartment complex thing. And
I don't know. I'm trying to see if you'll admit something if I stare you down.
She's doing like crazy eye with like the eyebrow really high. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Getting a little cartoonish.
All right.
Anyway, so he built this like crazy house and she's part of a demolition team where she goes in first and like figures out how the best ways to like demolish a building are.
Yes, because when I think of Misha Barton and all like 78 pounds of her, I think hammers, like swinging sledgehammers.
Well, no, she doesn't do that part. She's like the scientist-y one who figures out like through mathematics.
That's what
stuff.
I think of when I think of Misha Barton, mathematics.
And so she goes to this place and there are still some residents like living in the different apartments. And of course, all of them are like creepy and weird and bizarre. And you sort of start to find out that the guy who built it to sort of be this like torture chamber kind of thing. So I thought, well, I mean, that sounds good, but I just didn't care about her character at all. I mean, I don't know. I just thought she was really weak in it and you had to kind of be on her side and rooting for her for the movie to be successful. And having an old building that has all these like secret passageways and like torture rooms and stuff. I mean, normally that would creep me out, but I got none of that from this movie. Oh. So that was just an like total fail. I also watched Method with Elizabeth Hurley. It's like a movie where...
How do you not look at who's top billed and know to avoid?
I know. But she's like a method actress and she gets this role. She gets this role in like this period piece about this woman who has a girl and a little girl, and to like make money, she basically like kills her suitors, you know? And then of course she gets so wrapped up in the role that, you know, where does reality in the film sort of end or one begins?
Right.
And the problem, one of the main problems with this film that made it so bad is that in the parts where you're not sure whether it's in the parts where you're supposed to be sure that it's in the present, they're still in their costumes, which match the past. And so it's like so confusing that it's not interesting because you're constantly like, I don't know what's going on. Is this really happening? Is this a flashback? Is this a scene they're shooting in the actual movie that they're shooting? Or is she going crazy? And it wasn't like that good kind of confusion where it leads to suspense. It was just frustrating.
Like, they forgot to change wardrobe.
Exactly.
Between scenes.
Yeah. It just seemed like it was really poorly done. Okay, last one. I rewatched The Good Son.
Oh, I loved that movie when I was a kid.
I did too. I saw it when I was a kid. I remember one of my best friend's older brothers was watching it with his friends, and we like snuck in and watched it with them. And I was like, oh my God, this movie is amazing. It's so good and mm-hmm. so creepy. And on rewatch, not so much.
Is there a more effective way to make yourself feel old than to revisit that movie?
Yeah.
And see Frodo Baggins, like, he's basically a sperm. He's so fucking young.
Yeah. Yeah. But when I was a kid, I thought Macaulay Culkin was so creepy in that role, and he's just really not, you know, at all. Has anybody seen that since they were... Never seen it? Okay. No. Well, anyways, it does not hold up, so don't waste your time. It's free on Netflix, but I say stay away.
Awesome. Thank you.
Anyways, that's about it. I think Rachel's going to talk about some of the TV shows that I've been watching. So
I guess I'll take it from here. So, all right. Let me open up my notes. Okay. So I finally caught up with all the episodes of The River. Did anybody else watch this?
Yes,
I did.
Okay. So this is the Oren Peli film, you know, creator of... or director of Paranormal Activity. It's supposed to be sort of the found footage answer to TV. And the premise is there's this family, and they're kind of like crocodile hunter family, except for they're not Australian. And they they have this wildlife program that they do as a family. And so this kid has grown up on TV, and the dad is played by Bruce Greenwood, who is much better in Star Trek. The cool movie, so I'm not a dork. and he has, like, the family's sort of fallen apart in present day, and the son's gone off to medical school, and the wife is like off banging the dude from the Dresden Files, and he has gone into the Amazon in search of magic, because there's magic out there. That's the catchphrase, and they really want to drive that home.
Yeah, they say it like
1,000 fucking times. There's magic out there. And it's predicated on the fact that, okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself. He goes missing, and then like 6 months later, he has this beacon that goes off, and they're like, oh my God, he's still alive. So they mount this rescue thing, and they get out there, and they're followed by a camera crew, because the way that they've gotten funding to do the rescue is that they're doing a documentary about it, and they find a ship, and the ship is full of cameras because it's been this television show for all these years. So that's how the found footage works, right?
Yeah. You've got cameramen shooting it, plus all the cameras that are on the ship.
Right. So it's the son, the mom, the movie, like the camera guy who also was the dude that mom was banging. There's like a Latin American gentleman and his psychic daughter.
Work on the ship. They're like the mechanics.
There's like a mysterious like German mercenary who kind of looks like Clarence Rack, Liam Neeson.
Yeah, a little bit. That's right.
Thank you. And then there's some other camera people. And they go out into the jungle, and it kind of turns into a Monster of the Week thing.
Yeah.
As they search for this missing dude, and there's like magical dragonflies and evil dolls and
ghost ships and
demons, and it sounds like it'd be awesome. But...
yeah, it sounds amazing. And when I read about it, I was so excited. So I started watching it.
Had a great trailer.
Yeah, it had a great trailer, and the premise sounded really cool. It made by the Paranormal Activity people. I was sold. And then I was like really disappointed when I watched it, because like, I didn't feel like I cared about the characters very much.
Oh, the mom was the worst.
Yeah.
Her frizzy hair and, like, Skeletor face made me so angry.
I love it. That's what you focus on.
Well, I mean, there's these, like, big blue eyes all the time.
That's true. That are always, like, watery.
I'm gonna find him. I feel so guilty. I'm sorry I banged his friend. Oh. Like, yeah. But then you're also supposed to kind of, like, rally around her as, like, the strong female lead. But she's just, like, eyeballs and frizzy hair. I couldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know, so it's terrible, but it's the mom from the first season of 24 who was equally annoying in that role.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys remember her at all.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's like she's trying to be the empowered, strong woman, you know, going after her man, and she's going to do it. But you never really get that from her. Like, either she sucks as an actress, or they didn't write it very well.
I think it's a combination. I don't think probably. She's the right person for that role, but I also think that that role was written so, like, anemically. Like, there's just nothing to it.
And that's true of most of the characters. Like, even when there's, like, little cool things you find out about them, like the psychic girl, when you start finding out how much she knows about things, or the blonde girl that
Peaches.
When you find out that she has like the symbol on her neck that means that
which
she...
by the way, they never act like that's gonna be like the big reveal, and there's no, I mean, like, you just know, oh, she's marked.
Yeah, she's marked somehow, but what does that mean? Okay. At all. Anyways, so that's what I hated about it, on top of the fact that, like you said, monster of the week, but they just weren't scary.
Right. Well, my opinion is I liked the pilot quite a bit. I thought that, the characters were problematic, but I thought the Magus, which is the name of like this derelict ship that they're cruising down the Amazon on, was really like a cool setting. And I liked that I liked the whole being in the Amazon because it's so remote, and it's sort of, it lends itself easily to being very mysterious and being potentially somewhere where there would be like some old world magic. I don't know if maybe that's where Lost was actually located. And so that was cool. And some of the monsters of the week were interesting. Like, I liked the doll tree. I thought was really creepy. And the last two episodes, the finale and the one before it that had the zombies, was really cool. I liked that direction. At some point, they kind of find this sort of base, scientific base out in the middle of nowhere where there's been some zombie activity. That's pretty cool. And like, there's the guy that's in like the weird formaldehyde tank that has the bizarre bone structure on his back. Like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There were hints of things that were really interesting.
Which makes me feel like by the time it got to the end of the season, I was like, okay, this is getting better. There are definitely some cool things going on here. And the very like final reveal at the end, like, I won't say what it is, but that I thought was interesting.
It reminded me a little bit of Persons Unknown.
Yeah.
The ending.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And so if they make a second season, I think I would watch it because I would hope that they would continue with how they left off the first season. But
like, if they tinkered with the characters.
Yeah, exactly. Because I need to care about somebody on the show.
And there isn't anyone that you really identify with.
No, and they all kind of rub you the wrong way.
The son.
Over
he got
over
better
again.
After he cut his hair. I know it's like my gripes are so like picky, but it made a difference. I found his hair very upsetting. It was like, it looked like a bad, like he had like bad wig extension-y things. And
it was
he
always
like cut
really
it off.
Greasy
and his
too.
Character changed too. He went from being really whiny to kind of
taking charge
a little bit more, like, he and actually I do like that actor. He was in the Crazies remake. He was the partner.
Saw that.
Oh, okay.
It's on my next
did either of you guys watch The River, or did you get it over there in England?
No, haven't seen it.
How about you, Miss Sarah?
No, because I didn't like Lost.
I mean
to me, Lost was just a waste of an hour each week, and so I had, when they're talking about like Alcatraz and The River and all these things coming out, I'm like,
you're gonna wait till you got like it came out and everybody kind of commented on it.
No, I just had no interest.
Do you just not like those like ongoing dramas that you have to watch like
mysteries
every single week
kind of things?
Yeah, because you know, I don't necessarily. Like, I watch TV when I remember, like, something's on, and so for me, it's just, like, those things that where you have to watch every episode every week to find out what's going on. It's just tedious.
Gotcha.
I'll wait until it comes out on DVD and probably, you know, at least get the first disc from Netflix and give it a go. But,
I think tedious is the right word because it treads water for a few episodes.
It really
does.
It isn't
immediately clear that it's a monster of the week. You think it's a like, did you get that at all? Like those first few episodes, like I thought the demon, when it gets loose, like it was going to be.
Yeah. That was one of like big problems with it, is that each time they had something cool happen where like a demon or a ghost or something, I thought it was going to be a longer part of the storyline, but then they would like solve the problem. instantly.
It was like, how much danger are you in if you're able to solve it every week? I mean, right. I know that that's the conceit of the monster of the week.
But it's always done better. It's usually done better than that.
But doesn't it usually seems like you have to have some sort of skills. Like, okay, Supernatural is a monster of the week, and they, you know, for the most part, defeat. There's an overarching story, but then there's also, like, a critter that they kill every episode.
Right.
God, I know words, I swear.
But they've been, like, training for this their whole life, and they... Yeah, and they know, they have all the knowledge base to be able to fight these. These people just, like, are thrown together and have no idea what's going on. And then Randy and I were talking about this last night, that the whole... Rachel was saying that, you know, the magic out there is their little tagline. And it's basically when they get into the Amazon, all this stuff starts happening. And what would be cool is if they didn't really tell you what was going on, and that the characters were sort of slowly figuring out that something supernaturally was... That's not a word. Was happening.
We don't concern ourselves with appropriate
whatever.
Like, actual words around these parts.
But here it's like, as soon as something kind of crazy happens, the characters are just like, oh, it's magic. Okay.
Yeah,
that's
there's
it. It's just magic.
Nope, there's no, like, suspension of, you know what I mean? Like, nobody struggles with the fact that, like, maybe there's, like, a demon on the thing. Like, everyone's like, oh, okay, it's a demon. Cool.
Yep, oh, it's a ghost ship.
It's Wednesday. Why not? Okay. You know,
and because of that, you don't get as involved, and you don't get scared and wrapped up in it, and... There's none of that kind of suspense from it.
It's a shame, too, because, like, the premise itself could have been... I mean, it's really cool. Part of me hopes there's a second season, because I did really enjoy those last two episodes.
Yeah.
The zombie one especially. Like, instead of have it be a monster of the week, that should have been, like, three of the episodes.
I know.
You know, like, where they're trying to figure out what's going on there, where they actually discover them. Like...
Yeah, how are these zombies made?
The whole, like, thing about them, like, taking naps. I mean, there's cool things.
Yeah.
And then there's also the finding the indigenous people with the weird bone things on their back.
Yeah.
Was cool. But it just, like, they rushed
through
it.
Yeah, and then they left, and you don't see it again. Oh, well. Anyway, so there you go. The river.
We have some strong opinions on this, apparently. So the other show that I've been catching up on, and this isn't really necessarily horror, but I wanted to talk about it on the show just because I wanted to check in with Jody on it, is I finally caught up and I'm current with Mad Men. I marathoned the entire previous season.
Wow.
And then watched the premiere. And can I just tell you, I have that Zooby Zoo song stuck in my head for like 2 days walking around the house. Zooby Zoo, Zooby. I mean, like, oh, I wanted to like tear off my own ears.
I've actually never seen Mad Men.
What?
I know, my mom keeps telling me she wants me to watch it because, like, she was adopted by, like, upper middle class white people, and her dad had a job similar to the Mad Men. She's like, says that, you know, the dinner parties that her mom would host and stuff is so Mad Men like that she wants me to watch.
So anyways, that being said, I know that Jody, you had a little trouble watching it. You were not really digging it. And you were going to try watching the first few episodes. So I want to know how that went.
Oh, well, I was going to try, but I didn't, I have not got around to that yet. I mean, I did want to, you know, heed your advice, because you said to maybe give it like 3 or 4 episodes and see. Mm-hmm. And every time I've gone to watch it again, I just go, oh, you know what? I'm just not really in the mood. And I'm wondering if it's the type of thing where you're either interested or you're not. And maybe I'm just not. I mean,
sit down, have some Cutty Sark and a Lucky Strike, and, you know, you'll be good to go.
Do you think?
That show is so... I quit smoking years ago, but that show makes me want to smoke, so fuck that. Like, they're just sucking those things down. I'm just like, oh, yeah. Oh, smooth flavor country. Flavor country. Oh, it makes me want to smoke so bad. It just looks so amazing. It's like, I want to be ringed in blue smoke like that. It just,
just remember how bad it is.
But then, but then I smoke and I'm like, Another TV show that I've just recently been watching that's on Netflix that I think Jody will, if you're not watching it, you'll probably be familiar with, is Luther.
Oh, yeah. I know of it. I haven't seen it yet, but
it's not a strictly horror series. It's definitely, like, you know, sort of a cop procedural, but I think there's a lot there for horror fans, because it's really dark and gritty, and
yeah, it has aspects of like a serial killer kind of
well I mean the first movie. I mean, he kind of, in the first season, the first case that he has, he kind of actually ends up inviting a serial killer into his life.
Yeah.
Who is a reoccurring character. I actually quite like that character. I think she's mm-hmm. really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely is. It's not a show where every episode he solves the case and is wrapped up in the last minute and kind of swoops in and saves him. I mean, like, more times than not, they don't survive the
episode.
Yeah,
and like his life gets fucked up. And
right. Happens. And, you know, like, he's kind of a loose cannon. Mm-hmm. It's Idris Elba, who I love.
Yeah, he's
I
really
know.
Yeah.
Quite dreamy with his... Because, I mean, I loved him as Stringer in
Bell.
Yes,
Stringer
Bell
was
Wire.
Awesome.
And then to discover he had an English accent. Oh, yeah. Forget about it. It was a wrap. So, and he's great. He's really... He's kind of like... It's one of those things where he's just very much... I mean, if you were to actually date this man, it would be horrendous. Because every time he gets upset, he, like, punches his way through a door. But in terms of TV, he's riveting, you know?
Yeah.
And that show's actually... I don't really typically, I mean, that's not true, because I do watch some of them, but, like, the straightforward procedural things don't really do anything for me, for the most part. I mean, once in a while, I'll watch here and there, but there's just so many of them that I can't really get into it, but this is a rare exception where, I mean, because it's, yes, that is the, sort of the building blocks of the show. I mean, it is a police procedural, but it's just so, I mean, like, it's a weekly gut punch.
Yeah.
Like, there's an episode where someone, they take the captive, like, these people captive over some diamonds or whatever. And, you know, he's just like, I have to show that I'm serious about this. So I apologize in advance, you know, to threaten the guy. He walks over and cuts this woman's tongue out. And next time you see her, she's just, like, covered in duct tape, but there's, like, blood seeping out around her duct tape.
Right.
It's pretty great. So if you get a chance, I would check it out. Also, because it's a British show, there's only like four episodes per season.
Right.
So it's not a huge commitment.
Yeah. I've only seen the first season.
Well, I'm almost to the end of the first season. Like, someone died and I was like, what? I was quite shocked that they went there.
Yeah.
So that's always, I always like a show where nobody is safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It makes it so much more interesting.
Like, I really did not think this person was going to die. And then it's like, nope, they're dead.
Yeah.
They're all floppy on the floor. So, yeah, I definitely recommend Luther. The next thing I watched, this is an actual movie, can you believe it, is a film. I don't know if it's out in the UK or not. It just came out last week. It's called A Lonely Place to Die. And it's more thriller than horror. Have you seen this, Jodie?
No, but I've heard of it. Is that with Melissa George?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a big Melissa George fan.
Mm-hmm,
and the more
too.
I see her, the more I like her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think she got a lot of crap after 30 Days a Night, but I actually really like her.
Mm. You've just reminded me, can I just interject, of another movie I saw that I didn't mention? The Amityville remake.
Oh.
Yeah, because she's in that too. And,
is it good?
Not really, but
no.
But it's slightly elevated over what it should have been because it's got Melissa George and Ryan Reynolds and Chloe Moretz as sort of the three main actors.
Oh.
And Ryan Reynolds spends most of the time running around with a beard and no shirt, so that's pretty awesome. I mean, the movie itself is pretty crap, but it was well performed, I think. And it was better than it had any right to be because of the cast, I think. So I just wanted to throw that out because you just reminded me.
Awesome. Okay. Cool. Mild recommendation for him?
Mild, yeah. I mean, if you like Ryan Reynolds and Melissa George, I'd recommend it.
Awesome. Well, okay, so in this, it takes place in the Highlands of Scotland,
mm-hmm.
and Melissa George and a group of her friends are mountain climbers, and it starts off on the side of the mountain, and it's, from the moment this movie opens, it's pretty, like, relentless in terms of the pacing and the suspense. It's, you know, because there's the whole, if you don't like heights,
mm-hmm.
this movie's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. But they go out, they're mountain climbing, yay, that's fun, and they decide, they go back to the cabin, and one of the guys is kind of, he is inexperienced, and he almost kills them, basically, because of his inexperience and inability to stay focused. And she kind of just gives them the business, like, you can never... not be focused. That's a killer on these mountains. If you want to climb with me, you've got to up your game. And so the next day they head out and they're hiking to where they're going to climb this, you know, this mountain that's killed like 80 people. And along the way they start hearing these weird noises, like this echoing voice calling for help. And they find this drain pipe sticking out of the ground in the middle of the forest. And they can hear, like, it sounds like a child crying on the other end of it. And they dig it up, and there's this kid that has been buried in there with, who knows how long she's been in there. She's only got, like, a little bit of water.
Sure.
And they can't just leave her there. She's, she's Eastern European. She doesn't speak English. So they take her And they're out in the middle of nowhere, so they're trying to find their way back to civilization. And they split up into two groups to try to, one group's going to go the fast way that has to what is the word when you go down? Abseil mm-hmm. down, and the other group's taking the long way. But of course, just so happens that they're being hunted by the people who put her in there.
Sweet.
So it's definitely very like cat and mouse. And, there's one particularly, there's like one fall that's pretty brutal, and it's pretty plot twisty and good. I definitely recommend it. Like it's not a horror film, but if you like those thrillers that are kind of suspenseful and fast paced, this one's great. And I think Melissa George is really good in it. Like you buy her as someone that's really physically
capable,
but also she plays a very strong and powerful role. And there's never a moment where you're just like, you know, like Misha Barton, how I was joking, right, like, oh, right. Yeah, she's really swinging the sledgehammer. You don't get that at all. And you buy her in the role that she's in. And the little girl is really adorable and not obnoxious. You know how, like, kid actors mm-hmm. can ruin a film? I mean, maybe it's because she doesn't speak in English, but you definitely are like, oh, no, not Anna. Don't let them get Anna. You know, so it works on that level as well. So I definitely recommend A Lonely Place to Die.
Cool.
If you can get your hands on when it's on DVD, so you can definitely get your hands on it. Almost done. I got two more. Okay. So this next one is a TV show that I saw a review for it online. It's called, and I checked it out and I was like, oh my God, how the fuck did no one tell me that this exists? It's called Todd versus the Book of Pure Evil. Has anybody else seen this?
No.
I've seen bits of it.
Rachel just showed me an episode last night.
Okay, so it's this Canadian show that plays, I guess, on FearNet. It's just the first season's now out on DVD, and it's done like two seasons in Canada. I think there's going to be a third season. And it's this horror comedy that's set in a high school. So it's kind of like this weird mashup of like 80s movies, Buffy, and God, what would the third? The
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead. But then it's also like really ridiculous and violent and really un-PC. But basically there's this kid. He's like the stoner dude. He's like a metal guy. And his friend come across this book that's made out of Satan's scrotum. And it will allow you, like it seeks out vulnerable people and then like will make their wish come true. But like they always backfire and are something horrible. Like he becomes this metal god. But then like his music makes people's heads explode and makes them bleed out of their ass. And it's like the high school is Crowley High, and it's founded by Satan. The town's founded by Satanists, and the lead Satanist is played by the guy who plays Death in Supernatural. And I don't know, it's like ridiculous. There's tons of metal in it, and Jason Mewes is the janitor.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Which is awesome, and he's looking good and healthy. And And
I was
really
worried
funny.
About that.
I know. You're like, Jason Mewes makes me sad. I was like, no, he looks good. He looks healthy.
He's not all heroin-y anymore.
But it's definitely like, if you are someone who, you know, has a history as a Hesher or a fondness for that era and you like gore and like talking penises and and just things of that nature, I could not recommend that. It's so ridiculous. It's funny. I love it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the episode she showed me.
Yeah, so high recommendation for Todd versus the Book of Pure Evil. Just the name alone. I mean,
I know.
if the name intrigues you, you're going to like the show. But the best character is the guidance counselor. He's my favorite. Atticus Murphy Jr. So funny. He's the enemy, or villain, but he's fantastic.
Yeah, the way he talks is ridiculous.
Yes, I am your guidance counselor. Okay, so my last recommendation is this movie called Evidence. Have you guys seen this yet?
No.
No.
Okay. Well, I got to see a screener of this. It is it's like a found footage film, right? And it's the way it works is there is this group of friends, and one of them is a filmmaker, and he wants to make a documentary about his best friend who is camping for the first time. So, they go out and they're camping and everything's going great. Like the guy with the camera is kind of a dick, but he's sort of like have you ever had that friend who's like a dick and nobody really likes him, but you hang out with him anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Well, he's that dude. And, they're hiking and they see basically this, like, they don't know what it is, but it's like this creature And it's a really scary looking thing. And they get freaked out and everybody wants to leave except for the camera guy, of course, who won't let them leave. And, you know, it starts picking, like they find like, or this, it starts picking them off basically. I mean, it sounds pretty straightforward, but if I talk any more plot wise, it will kind of ruin the film because this is like the biggest what the fuck movie I've seen in a long time. Like it's one of those movies where you watch the trailer and you think it's one kind of movie, but it's something completely different. And once it gets going, it's another one that just like does not stop. And as I was watching, I just kept looking at Randy like, what the fuck is happening? Because it's just so much is changing and you have no idea where it's going. I can see that it's probably going to be a divisive film. Like if I overhype it, it will, I think you could overhype this movie, but if you go into it just kind of up for anything, it's definitely a lot of fun and it has some really great moments and you will not see it coming. I guarantee it. Cause it,
well, that's good. I like that.
It's a trip like where it goes. And, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I would say if you get a chance to see Evidence, you should definitely check it out. It's got like an unknown cast, which I always like with a found footage film, because if I'm recognizing people, it's a little bit harder to buy into the scenario.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So definitely check that out. So awesome. That is my what you've been watching 2 hours later.
I know.
I guess we shouldn't go so long between episodes. We just watch too much horror. Of course, if we do them like closer together, everyone's like, oh, I haven't really been watching anything.
Yeah.
Have you guys been catching up on the Big Bang Theory? So that's it for what you've been watching. A very thorough examination of what we've been doing for the last month. It's amazing we have jobs. Like, how we have time. So we talk a little bit about the actual movies.
Yeah.
Starting with
Silence.
All right. Who would like to go first? Who would like to synopsize The Silence of the Lambs for us?
Go on then. Right.
So, I love you, Joey.
Thanks. Yeah, right. Okay. So Silence of the Lambs. I guess very briefly, the story is about a serial killer on the loose. His nickname is Buffalo Bill. And he's killed, I don't know how many women, 5 or 6 women at this point. And one woman is currently missing. And so the FBI are trying to investigate this. And so they want to talk to this psychiatrist / serial killer, Hannibal Lecter, who's incarcerated in some mental asylum. So they send this young FBI trainee agent named Clarice Starling to go and talk to him to get information to try and get into the killer's head, and so ensues the procedural stuff to try and catch the killer. That's the setup of the movie.
Boom.
Good.
Yep.
Well done. Very not thorough.
I like it though.
That's great. You know, I have so much trouble like whittling things down.
Yeah.
And you do it so effectively that if you don't want to do the synopsis, stop being so damn good at it. It's like drop a plate if you don't want to wash dishes.
Maybe I'll stop.
No, I tried that. I just get told I have to pick up the mess.
Your girlfriend is funny. All right. So what did you guys? Okay, this is like I think pretty almost it's widely regarded. That's the word I'm looking for, as being one of the best thrillers ever. It's, you know, it definitely, I think because of the serial killer content, kind of blurs the line between thriller and horror. So I feel like it's something we can easily talk about here. This film for me was definitely kind of like a watershed moment in my life. I saw it right at the right time. And by right time, I mean at 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the theater, I don't know what my mom was thinking, but somehow me and my friend talked my mom into taking us to see this.
Awesome.
We're sitting in the theater and like, you know, Migs is talking about smelling cunts and throwing splooge in people's faces. And, you know, Buffalo Bill's like, could not understand what happened. But like when he's like tucking himself behind his legs. I don't know what my mom was thinking. But at the point where Hannibal bites someone's face off, she leapt up and ran out of the theater, leaving me and my 11-year-old friend behind.
That's awesome.
And like some like kind usher assured her that that was the scariest part and it was going to be okay and just give it a few minutes and go back in. But my mom was like quite traumatized, but I was enthralled.
Yeah.
I like walked out of that theater completely obsessed. Clarice Starling was my hero. I was going to be an FBI agent. Serial killers were awesome. I needed to buy like every Time Life serial killer book out there. And a lifelong obsession began.
And the same thing, exact same thing happened to me. I saw it at home when I was like 10 or something, and I fell in love with it. And for years, I wanted to be Clarice Starling. Mm-hmm. Like, I
definitely wanted... still kind of do.
Yeah.
How about you guys?
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
We're so polite.
I know.
Go, Jody.
Okay. I saw this. I'm trying to think how old I was. Maybe 13 or 14. And it's kind of movie that I saw when I was probably too young, not because it disturbed me or upset me, but because I didn't really get what the movie was saying, similar to Seven, you know, and then I saw it again much later and thought, wow, you know, like a lot of stuff kind of went over my head, similar to this movie, and I kind of wish I'd waited until I was a bit older, but you know, so it would be more impactful the first time I saw it. But yeah, definitely, I totally want to be an FBI agent when I was watching this. Definitely.
Which is kind of funny because it's not like she has a, you know, like it's not like
it's so glamorous or something.
Right. You know what I mean? Like she has a good time doing it.
Yeah,
it's pretty
but
brutal.
I wanted to be a profiler. Like I wanted to profile serial killers. That's what I wanted to do.
Definitely.
How about you, Sarah?
Yeah, well, I saw this in the theater. I thought it was cool, but I'd already had like a real love of horror films from when I was a kid. And you know, I don't know. I really like this. I thought it was really cool. It definitely sparked an interest in serial killers too. And I didn't necessarily want to be an FBI agent because I know all the stuff they had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I thought it was definitely cool to like look into other serial killers and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So now having had you know a pretty large impact upon like initially viewing it, you know, pretty young age or whatever. Going back and seeing it after several years, I wonder, you know, like, are there diminishing returns or does it still hold up? For me, it absolutely, I turned to Ariel about, I don't know, 35 minutes into it. And I'm like, fuck, this movie is good.
Yeah.
But I want to know for you guys, did it still hold up after all these years? I mean, it's a 20-year-old film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's better as time goes on because I remember when it was my best friend Ellie recommended this to me because you know how like sometimes your parents don't let you watch certain movies and they don't let you stay up that late, but you've always got that friend who you know their mum lets them watch whatever they want.
That would be my mom.
So my friend Ellie, you know, her mum was really cool and just let us watch whatever we want. So she showed me this and Predator and, you know, all these other cool movies that I probably shouldn't have been watching at that age. But I remember her describing it to me before we watched it. She's like, oh yeah, it's about this guy and he skins women and everything. I'm like, wow, that sounds awesome. And then there's not actually a lot of, you don't even see any skinning or anything like that in the movie. So I remember watching it thinking, oh, well, it's cool, but it wasn't really what I was expecting. And then it was, you know, a couple of years later when you watch it and then you pay attention to the story and you hear all these things. And that's when it gets under the skin, as it were.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's an interesting thing that I think when we get to Hannibal, we'll have to talk about is kind of the real lack of on-screen violence and yet how impactful I think this movie really is. Like it does a really good job of showing you very little and yet still really kind of delivering the horror, like the
you still feel all of it
impact of what these men are doing to people.
True. And quite a lot of people apparently almost got involved with the movie but then pulled out because it was too disturbing for them, like the content was too disturbing, even though there's not actually a lot that happens visually. I mean, I hear that Gene Hackman was going to direct and star as Hannibal and Michelle
glad that didn't happen.
And Michelle Pfeiffer was going to be Starling. She was initially considered for Starling, which could have turned out very differently.
Yeah, but then, I bet they were kicking themselves on Oscar night.
Right. Yeah. But then I don't think they realized at the time. I mean, I think they knew that it was a big movie when they were making it, but I don't think they realized, you know, how popular it was going to be and how many Oscars that they won.
Yeah, because it swept that year. It was basically everything. And yeah. I remember that was like the 1 year I ever really watched the entire Oscars.
Right.
And I can remember like when it kept winning, I was like, yes! And then since then I've been like repeatedly disappointed.
Right.
But that was the 1 year, like it was called right. The Wish Fulfillment with the Oscars. Like the movie that I truly, truly loved actually won
something.
And going back and seeing it, I mean, obviously as a kid, I loved it. I was enthralled. But the actual performances, Anthony Hopkins is riveting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know. He does something so good
with his eyes that could be caricature because he like kind of like halfway bugs them out.
Right.
But that it just encapsulates that perfect balance of brilliance and madness.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And he doesn't yeah. blink a lot in the movie.
Yeah, and you feel like he's just like sort of staring through her.
Yeah, know? Yeah. And I think the way that it's filmed, like a lot of shots of the dialogue scenes, they're looking right at the camera. You don't see any like over the shoulder shots of each other talking.
Right.
A lot it's very POV. The whole
yeah, movie. It's right in your face, and they're talking right at you. And yeah, it's really effective.
Yeah, you just don't want to look away when he's on screen.
Mm, mm.
And he's only on screen for like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's only really in like four scenes, and you forget, you know, like half the movie he's not even there. And at the very end, when he's on the phone, you go, oh yeah, I forgot about him.
And then Buffalo Bill is just so, I mean, he's great too and creepy. And I hadn't seen this movie for like probably 6 years or so, and I'd only started watching Monk a couple years ago, and so when I watched this, I heard the voice of Buffalo Bill when he's first, you know, pulling the girl into the van or pushing her into the van with the chair, and I was like, oh my god, it's Stottlemyre. What the fuck?
And then you see no mustache equals evil.
Yeah.
Mustache equals good.
And then you see him later, like, you know, dancing around with the woman's head wig on his and, you know, tucking himself. And I'm like, oh my god. This is traumatizing.
Yeah. It was weird to kind of go back and see that.
Yeah.
Well, my cousin's wife, she was at the time that she saw that Silence of the Lambs was in theater, she was the same size as the senator's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that, you know, she had seen it. She'd gone out with a friend, and she lived in Southern California, and where she lived was like an hour and a half from the theater. So, like, she gets out of the movie, and she's driving home, and American Girl comes on her car stereo, and she flipped the fuck out. She like, turned around and went back to her friend's house and would not go home till sun came up.
That would be creepy.
Can I just say, for the record, best Tom Petty song, American Girl.
Yeah. Yes.
The good one.
I just want to put that on the record.
So, should we talk about Clarice now?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about some of the side characters so that we can really focus on Clarice.
Okay.
So let's talk about Buffalo Bill as a villain. Now, he's someone that's really a peripheral character in this, and he's amalgamation of like many actual serial killers,
right?
Like Ed Gein and
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy.
The other guy, I forget his name. The guy that had a pit or a well in his house, I forget his name.
Ugh. So disturbing. So despite kind of being peripheral, he is, I think he's, I don't know if it's the way he's written or the way he's performed or it's just that voice that he has.
Mm.
He's such a terrifying figure. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it, the way that it was shot is so smart with him, where, yes, we're looking directly into the eyes of Clarice Starling and into the eyes of Hannibal Lecter and basically everybody else. But we only see him like in pieces. Like a lot of it's just little shots of parts of his body, or he's never up until you actually see him in the well scene and the kidnapping scene, you're only getting glimpses of him. Mm-hmm. And it's juxtaposed against this horrific torture chamber, labyrinthian background where there's like, you know, he's working on mysterious leather, and the music that they're using is really creepy and does a great job of making him this mysterious and terrifying figure.
And he does the actor does such a good job with
that
him
voice.
Too. Yeah, the voice is great.
So
and
fuck me.
I know.
Yeah.
I fuck me so hard.
Yeah.
Please don't isolate that and turn it over to us.
And like in the scene where the senator's daughter is in the pit and she starts crying for her mom, she's like, "Mommy, I want my mommy." You see, he's like looking down at her, and first he's kind of angry, but then his chin starts to quiver and his lip starts to quiver a little bit because he's like feeling for her. You kind of see a glimmer of it, and then he gets pissed at her.
Well, you also get details later that he has had like some really traumatic childhood experience. Mm-hmm. And you kind of almost get the feeling, and that's why he's dehumanizing her a little bit.
Yeah, where he
and
calls
it's
her
starting
it.
that the whole like it puts the lotion on its skin is sort of like shattering for a second. And but once he pushes through it, it turns into the sadist again.
Exactly, but like I think a lesser actor, it wouldn't have been as believable. But you just like you see it, even though it's subtle, you see it so clearly in just his facial expressions, you know.
Right. And considering that his on-screen time is so small, this is true of almost everybody in this film, that he still manages to become very much like a pop culture.
Yeah, he made a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. I mean, going back and revisiting, what do you guys think of the Buffalo Bill character?
Really, really creepy. And did any of you guys read the book? I mean, I read it a long time ago, but I don't really remember a lot about it because they don't really explain a lot about his background and why he became a serial killer, really. You get little glimpses, but you don't get as much as you do in the book, as I understand it, which, you know, can make it more scary, you know, in a Michael Myers kind of way, that you wonder what led him to this point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that both of these films are examples of films that are actually better than the book, though.
Okay.
What do you think about that?
Well, I've just read Red Dragon not long ago because I intended to read all three. How many are there now? Four? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I didn't really like it that much. I mean, I don't think... I think Thomas Harris has some really cool ideas and really dark ideas, and that he fleshes out these characters very well. But I don't really like the way he tells a story and the way he describes action scenes and things like that. It doesn't really kind of make a lot of sense. You know, I mean, the climax to Red Dragon, I had to read it a couple of times because I'm like, what just happened? I don't understand. Where did he come from? You know, and it doesn't really just make a lot of sense in my mind. But I think the characters that he creates are excellent, and the stories that he comes up with, I just don't think they're, I don't know, structured in a very good way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that what you found with Lambs as well?
Here's the thing is, I think with the film, a lot of times, obviously, you have to take shortcuts. Characters get cut out and plots get boiled down a little bit. And in the way that they did it with the film, it actually better serves the characters. I think that the film version of Clarice has a lot more agency than the book does. A lot of the discoveries that are made in the film are things that are told to her in the book. The whole thing with the anagrams is cut out because there's this whole procedural part where, like, you know, she turns over the report, then what's his face, her boss, I can't think of his name,
Crawford,
you know, he does some investigation, then he's like, why don't you know, I can't really give you, you know, like, I can't give you any credit even though you're taking time off of school, but if you want to take this on your own, you can, and she's and so there's this whole procedural part that gets excised from the film, and what replaces it is her really putting things together. Mm-hmm. Like the skin suit, when she sees the darts on the dress and realizes, oh my God, he's making this. That's something that Hannibal Lecter tells her in one of the early interviews.
Oh.
In the book.
In the book.
Right.
And so it kind of, she is much less a driving force for the investigation in the books than she is in the film.
Mm.
There's a lot more spent on her feeling, like her internal dialogue about being, like men dismissing her and them finding her attractive, and because of that dismissing her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more of that going on. It's hinted at in the film, and I think it's a little heavy-handed in the book. So I like the way they handle it more in the film.
Yeah, because they just give you glimpses of that.
Like the whole head thing is much more complicated. It's Hannibal's victim. It's not Hannibal's victim. It's the boyfriend of Hannibal's victim. And there's this whole thing where they're trying to, the way that they're narrowing down on Buffalo Bill at the end is they're trying to figure out who this Klaus guy is, who was like a merchant marine from Scandinavia. It's so much better that Hannibal just found it and kind of creates this weird. What's the word where you have like a scene where you set a scene
tableau
for her to discover. with right, the whole, like, right. miss the rest of me. I loved all of that. Yeah. So I really feel like
yeah, and the way she figures out the anagram of, like, the name, and, you know, she goes in to talk to him when he's in that cage thing. Like, no, everybody else is just assuming this is the guy's actual name, and she's the only one that's kind of putting it together.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I love that scene, too, where they have the SWAT team busting in the doors of where they think James Gum is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And then the doorbell ringing, and it opens, and it's just like little Clarice there.
And you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, yeah. Well, initially that was filmed as two separate scenes. So you've got the whole bit with the SWAT team moving in, and then it starts with Clarice arriving at James Gum's house. So I love the way it was, because then they then chopped it up and mixed it all around, so you assume that they are arriving at the right house, and then
yeah,
it's empty.
It's so effective.
And then you go, shit. And then it's like, oh, hi, sorry to bother you. And, like, it's just so much better that way, and I don't understand how they...
What were they thinking?
Yeah, it just seems like such a boring way, because, I mean, there's an alternative scene on one of the on DVD, and, yeah, it just doesn't work. It's just, yeah, boring, like you say.
And well, you also come to the same conclusion at the same moment as Jack Crawford does, where he's like, Clarice!
Yeah,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is kind of a little corny, but still, it's what you're thinking as an audience member. You're like, no, not Clarice!
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so should we talk a little bit about Clarice Starling?
Yeah.
Okay, so who wants to lead this? I feel like I've talked so much on this episode.
Okay, well...
it's just when I go back and I listen to this, I feel like I'm so sick of my voice at the end. I'm like...
Well, that's probably just because you're editing it, so you're having to listen to it more than me.
And
because
I never shut the fuck up. It's a killer combo. Proceed.
Okay, well, I mean... I love Jodie Foster in this role. I love the character of Clarice. And from the very start, when she first, you know, in the early scenes where she begins to interview Hannibal Lecter, she does such a great job of, like, conveying everything just with the camera on her face, like, through these subtle expressions. Mm-hmm. And you see her as being, like, just from the way that she's composed herself and the facial expressions, you see that she's scared, sort of nervous to be there, unsure of herself, but still feels like she's capable.
Yeah, like, you know that, what I mean? That bit where he's sort of dissecting her background and saying that she's white trash and everything like that. Mm-hmm, and you can see her, she's kind of like, you can see it bubbling up inside her, but you can tell that, you know,
yeah, she's tamping it down.
Yeah, yeah, and that her heart is pounding, and then she's like, well, you see a lot, doctor, and you can tell that she's like, she comes out and bursts into tears, and that's what she wanted to do right there, but she held it all in and held her own, even though, you know, you can tell that she's totally petrified and nervous about saying what she's about to say.
Yeah,
and I also get the sense that there's sort of an untapped rage there too, like she's fuming and she's just like, oh, you see a lot, I like to see what you see, you know, but you're a coward, you won't look with the same sort of laser precision at yourself.
Yeah, and she's willing to say that to him, and like when he starts talking about sex stuff and she says, I'm just not really interested in that,
yeah, know? And it kind of throws him too, because he's so calm and cool and everything, but then she says that to him, like, why don't you point that perception at yourself, and he kind of doesn't know what to say, and then he tries to scare her by, oh well, a census taker once tried to test me, look what I did to him, kind of thing, and she is kind of fazed by that, and that's when, like, for a moment he's kind of had enough, and he's kind of like, she's gotten to him, and then he's like, okay, you can fly back to school now, little starling, and then it's almost over,
right,
until she gets money shotted by Nick.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, I totally, like, Rachel and I were talking about this. Yeah, I thought he spit at her. I did not get it. And I did not get the cunt line at all.
I know, I was like, I can smell your cut? What?
I was like, what the hell does that mean? I don't get it.
But as an adult, like, that was the scene. I mean, people get skinned, you know, there's horrible things that happen. People get their faces eaten off. But the scene I was most dreading was the money shot. I was just like, here it comes, literally, here it comes.
But I also love her reactions, like, when she sees horrific things. Like, when she's first being led down to Lecter and the icky psychiatrist guy shows her the picture of the nurse, and you see it on her face, like how horrified she is by what she sees, and she still, you know, goes in there. And then when they find the woman's body, I can't remember the name of the woman, but she has, you know, the cuts out of her back and all of that.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
And you know, the Crawford sort of dismisses her a little bit to go and talk with the sheriff, and then she ends up telling all of the marshals and stuff to leave the room. Like, she takes control, and when she starts to examine the woman's body, like, you can hear her voice quivering and her sort of, like, uncertainty as she goes through it, but she's still getting everything right, you know, like, she's still figuring out what's going on, and, like, she's the first one to notice there's something in her throat and make those kind of connections.
Yeah, there's a definite determinism there, like,
and a
defiance, like you say, when she walks down into the prison for the first time, and she gets sort of reassured by Barney, like, don't worry, you'll do fine, and you can see her sort of, okay, here we go. And then when she turns around to look at the body, and you can see her kind of, like, brace herself, and it's and it's kind of like she doesn't want to do it, but she's so determined to do her job well and to learn, and she'll make herself do it, even though she's on the brink of tears when she's talking into the little tape recorder and everything, and, you know, she's looking at...
And Jodie Foster does such a good job of
definitely.
I think she's has that perfect balance of capability and vulnerability. She's incredibly ambitious and determined. I think that's the right word for it. But she's not... She's definitely multifaceted, you know? She's inexperienced, and she's, you know, having to fight her way through something that is really challenging. And as an audience, it's really easy to identify with someone that has that bit of vulnerability to them. It's not just total wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
It's like an actual fully
realized
character. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And something that I heard Jodie Foster saying about playing the character was that she wanted to play her as human and not superhuman. I mean, she's
that's very accurate.
Because she's kind of, you know, she's brave, but she's also petrified throughout this whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of badass, but she's also, you know, very scared and nervous, and, you know, her voice is quavering all the time when she's trying to, like, in the scene where she goes down into the basement and everything.
It's so good.
Yeah, and every time she opens the door, she kind of, like, oh my god, like, almost jumps, you know, even though there's nothing
there. Like, you see her almost jump out of her skin, and when she first enters Buffalo Bill's house, and
you
can see the wheels turning in her head, like realizing what's going on, and then she sees the moth and she's like, oh fuck, and she starts to unbuckle her gun, you know.
Yeah, and then she pulls her gun out, and I don't know if it was deliberate or if it was kind of a blooper, but she kind of stumbles a bit. She goes freeze, and then she sort of has her gun and sort of fumbles a little bit, and then she's like, put your hands up. And if you compare that to, there's a very brief scene earlier where she's at the shooting range, you know, and she's just so still and calm and hitting the target. But now
she's in a real situation with a real killer.
But I like how they did those sort of parallels with her training, and then, okay, this is a real situation now.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, when she's in the car with Crawford, and Crawford's like, okay, so give me the profile. And she's like, well, he's, you know, 30s or 40s, you know, he's got this type of build probably, and he lives in a house, not an apartment. And he's like, yes, very good. So she's applying, you know, what she's learnt to the situation.
Right.
I think those are also really great ways that they kind of underline her character and her strength and her ability without it being really heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, repeatedly you see her kind of using her training and being very incisive and insightful. She sees the moth, she puts together she puts together the darts. Being the
right
human. And you know what I mean,
like, in the anagram,
she's a little bit ahead, even despite her her lack of experience, she's a little bit ahead of the game. Like, she figures out, like, right away she's picking up on cues, like when she's examining the body and she's like, you know, I see the glitter nail polish and different things. She recognizes that means that she's town and not local. But I also think that they're in that point, you're seeing her really identify with the victim, because you'll notice it's in West Virginia, which we know she's from because of what Hannibal has said. And she's this young girl.
Yeah, and also when she goes to the bedroom of, is it the first victim? She goes to visit her father, and she's looking at her bedroom, and she picks up the little box, and she immediately goes to the lid of the box to find the Polaroids behind, because, and you get the sense that, you know, she
was probably
hid
something there.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly. Yeah, so she knows right where to look.
Yeah, and I think there is, it's interesting because for the same things that we're seeing that her strengths are things that make people around her maybe more dismissive.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, she has this woman's intuition from being able to kind of step into, identify with these victims. But at the same time, they're looking at her for her gender and kind of, like, dismissing her, especially that group of men. And then Jack Crawford
specifically plays into that prejudice.
Yeah.
Yeah, to work it to his advantage. And I love how she kind of calls him on it. Like, you know, she's like, that bothered you, didn't it, Starling? And she's like, yeah, because they look to you.
It matters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she didn't fly off the handle at the time. No, go, hey, not at wait all. A minute. You know, she was a professional about it and she
let it happen
later. Yeah.
Well, we'll see how that happens in the second film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So overall, I mean, Sarah, did you want to say something about Clarice? I'm sorry.
I love Jodie Foster in this role. I think it's one of my favorite roles of Jodie Foster. For me, what really, really makes it is the scene in Buffalo Bill's basement the dark where he keeps reaching out to her and she's spinning around.
I know, just it's so creepy.
That sheer anxiety and panic, and she really brings in that claustrophobia of the darkness. And even though we can see her and we know he can see her through the goggles, it's just that absolute panic that that just shows on her face and in her breathing and
her gun hand shaking.
Yeah. And she's got her arm out in front of her.
And she's spinning, and it's just, it's phenomenal. It's such a great scene. And I think that really, really is the strength of Clarice Starling, that she gets through that.
Yeah.
Because everything else, you get the feeling that she's kind of overcompensates to get over being poor white trash. Like, I'm willing to bet she was, top of her class in the FBI Academy and could tell you, this page, this manual, but it's the putting it in practice. It's like like you said, the scene with the range versus pulling her gun out for the first time and slipping and
Definitely. That's actually something they talk a little bit about in the books, is that she is she has this really humble background, and that she is incredibly driven. And that's one thing I really like about her, is she's very, very ambitious. And that part of why she was drawn to this is because she's able to use the rules and use the system to excel in a way that she can't in other areas because of her humble background.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like Sarah was saying something and we cut her off.
I think she was shouting at a cat.
Oh, is that what I thought? I couldn't hear that.
What it sounded like. It
sounded like get down or something.
Was it a cat or was it a pig?
It was a cat. I'm not at my parents' place. I thought I muted that.
No.
I look over and the cat's walking across the dining room table. I'm like, hey.
I thought you were maybe very upset that I jumped in. I'm like, oh dear. It's the wrath of Sarah. Here it comes. All right. So the only other thing really I want to talk about was the chemistry. The chemistry of Hannibal Lecter and Jodie Foster in this film. In the book, there really isn't any of that. Like, they don't really allude to there being that there's an attraction there. I think there is a combination of a sociopath who kind of wants to entertain himself and someone who is incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
And that they've come together for
they're both using each other.
To a certain extent. Yeah. Now on film, there's such I feel like there's so much chemistry between the actors.
Mm-hmm. There is, but it's like a very, they have respect for each other,
definitely.
Mutual respect that gets just thrown out the window in Hannibal.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why I'm bringing it up in this movie, so that we can, when we get to Hannibal, talk about
this. It's a mutual respect and he, especially at the end where, they ask, do you think he's going to come after you? And she's like, no, he'd find that rude. Because he does have that respect for her. He thinks she did a good job, that, she's one of the good guys and he's willing to let her be. Yeah. And, but in Hannibal says, they say that he only goes after people that he finds rude.
Yeah. Free range rude.
Free range rude. Right. That's what it was. That's pretty a great line, actually. When I saw this initially when I was young, I remember, there was a little bit of like a romance to it, you know, from a child's, like, young perspective, mm-hmm. That's easy to romanticize things. And he's,
right.
you know, behind bars, and he's, like, drawing these drawings of her with the lambs or whatever. So yeah. I saw a romantic interpretation, but as an adult watching it, you know, like, and kind of having a deeper understanding of what kind of person Hannibal would be if he were, like, right. a real character, right. there's no romance there. But they're no. so electrifying on screen, there's so much chemistry, and there are two actors who are just really kind of at their peak, like
yeah,
there's like that lightning in a bottle moment,
mm-hmm.
but I think instead of recognizing that for what it was, they go a completely different direction,
right? Right, like in this one, it's very clear that there's mutual respect, and that yeah, that the actors worked so well together that there is that electricity, and then they just kind of ruin it later on. Like, they yeah. there is no real, like, there's not sexual chemistry and romance, really. There's just this yeah mutual respect in a different kind of chemistry.
There's
and
an electricity sort of, there. There's just yeah. something, a kind of an undefinable, like,
yeah,
right.
chemistry.
And when we talk about Hannibal, they really tap into that and kind of ruin it.
They,
like,
simplify it.
Yeah, I think it's almost fabricated by Hannibal in some way, as in Hannibal Lecter in the first movie, because you know, he's asking her about sex and things, and he's kind right. of doing it deliberately to get a reaction out of her. Like when he's asking her about when she lived on the ranch, oh, why did you run away? Mm-hmm. Did he make you perform fellatio? And she's like, no, nothing like that. And then he's talking about, oh, what about Jack Crawford? Do you think he wants to have sex with you? And she's like, I'm not interested. You know, I don't want to talk about this.
He's trying to get a rise out of her,
yeah,
and
definitely.
See what her reaction would be.
Yeah,
and there's also the line about, like, I think it must be something to know you in real life. Mm-hmm. So maybe there is an attraction there, but I think it's definitely very one-sided.
Yeah. And also when she goes to see him, when he's in Memphis in the cage, and she comes to see him and brings his drawings back, and he says, people will say we're in love. And he's just kind of, not toying with her exactly, but he's just having kind of like a little, it's almost a little private joke between them now.
Mm-hmm.
But he's doing it because he knows that that's not what she's interested in at all.
Right.
But there is that little electrifying moment where their fingers touch.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's why I say I think maybe there is a little bit of a one-sided infatuation there.
Yeah, because you see their fingers touch and he strokes her
but
finger.
It's not a love story.
No.
Is my point.
No.
It's
no.
not a love story. There's no future for these two.
No.
It's quite interesting that line you mentioned when he says, I think it would be quite something to know you something like that. But he's drawn to her in the way that, like, I mean, everyone's drawn to her in this movie, I think, for different reasons, and mostly it's for a sexual reason. But I think for Lecter, it's because she's got a pure heart, and he can see that in her. So
yeah,
she's very,
like,
frank.
Noble
he's like
her,
right, and then at that point he's complimenting her for being very frank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that everybody else in this movie is very manipulative. Everyone has sort of an agenda that is.
Yeah.
You know, maybe less than honorable, like Chilton trying to take her out for a night on the town in Baltimore.
Sure.
Everything about that sentence is horrible.
It is horrible.
And no, Baltimore in the 90s? Jeez.
You're right.
Yeah. Right. You wonder how many people have tried to go and talk to Lecter and he's just sent them away in tears, you know, and he has a little chuckle to himself. And then she comes in, this young, you know, how old is she meant to be? I don't know, like 23 or something. And he thinks, oh, this is going to be an easy one. And she doesn't. And she stands up for herself. And he's like, interesting. Okay. And then he doesn't want to toy with her anymore. He wants to find out more about her, and I guess he is in a way manipulating her on some level, because he wants to get this deal and he wants to be able to get to a better you know, prison and everything, to have a view and all this kind of thing. But
and I think people's minds are sort of his playground anyway.
Yeah And I also get the sense that he's not, because he's not the villain in this movie. A lot of people say that he's like the best on-screen villain and everything, but he's not the villain of this piece at all. Buffalo Bill's the villain, and Lecter just happens to be a sociopathic serial killer, but he's not the villain of the movie. And he's
not at all.
No, and he's I can't remember where I read this now, where I heard it, but someone said that he's a good man just locked up in an insane mind.
Yes,
I quite like, because
that's a good description.
Yeah,
I like that.
Because like you say, you know, he eats the rude, and you know, he doesn't he doesn't go after Starling, he goes after Chilton at the end, because
oh, right. It's the best.
best. So yeah. Good. I'm going to have an old friend for dinner tonight.
Yeah. And I love that line. It's really good. But I think they do that too much in Hannibal. That's another problem I had.
Yeah.
Someone like, oh, yes, New England. I've had many excellent meals there. And you go, oh, he's talking about eating people.
Yeah. They take it way too far. They basically take everything too far to a point where it's unrealistic.
Sure.
I do like, though, in Hannibal when they mentioned that he ate the flute player. To better the symphony.
Yeah. Like it was for the greater good. Yeah.
You know, I think that this movie is just it. That's the strength of this one over the. I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but is that whereas Hannibal is super ham-fisted, this one is very subtle. Mm-hmm. It does not like it doesn't condescend to its audience. It's not trying to. I think the next movie it's definitely trying to skew more and get kind of like you know. The more horror audience in there, as opposed to this one, I think is trying to do something a little bit more highbrow, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, even for this genre. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. This is not Tree of Life.
There is subtlety to it that there isn't in the next one.
Sure. And when we're talking about the chemistry between these two, I think a lot of it has to do with the actors, with Foster and Hopkins, mm-hmm. because apparently they didn't talk a lot off screen. They met for the first time when they just had one rehearsal together, as a whole cast. And then the next time they met was when they did that scene. And they were both kind of not scared of each other, like kind of in awe of each other, because, you know, he's this like huge actor and everything. And she just won an Oscar for The Accused. So they're both kind of...
Feeling each other out a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and a bit daunted. And I guess they didn't realize that the other one was feeling the same sort of thing, you know.
Cause... That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, so they were kind of a bit wary. And then apparently, it was when the movie was over, they were both, had a laugh together and, you know, became friends after that. But throughout the whole filming of it, they didn't really talk much and they were quite wary of each other. So I think a lot of that comes across.
Can you imagine as just being a person on the other side of plexiglass?
Mm-hmm.
From that, Anthony Hopkins looking at you like that, it must be incredibly intimidating.
I would imagine, yeah.
That's the word I was looking for, intimidating.
I mean, like, it just, even if, put aside his career and who he is, I mean, just the look on his face would be so...
because he's so good at that character, but he really embodies it. And
there's a moment, I think it's when she comes back and she's like, she's been in the rain after she's found the head, where and because the way the film is shot, where it's all like point of view, where there's sort of a duality in terms of like their eyes, like they're both kind of the intensity that both of them are bringing to their facial expressions. I mean, it's just like it heightens sort of the tension of the film and like gives despite it not being really action packed, there's so much momentum in this movie, even when there's very little actually happening on screen. And I think it's to do with performance and soundtrack and atmosphere, all of that. But there's just such momentum throughout this entire movie.
Yeah, you just want to want it to keep going and you want to keep seeing what's going to happen next. It keeps you enthralled all the way through.
Yeah, and I think in some ways it goes against your expectations because we hear all this stuff about Hannibal Lecter at the beginning of the movie about how he's this monster and he, you know, like at this nurse's eye and everything like that. And you think you're going to find the Joker or something in this asylum in a straitjacket. And then, you know, you see him and he's just standing in the middle like he's expecting her. And he's just like, good morning, you know, and he's like, oh, please have a seat. And he's just this.
Right.
I guess nowadays maybe that's kind of a cliche, the civilized, well-spoken, psycho serial killer. But I don't know. It's just really unnerving. And, he's all neat and he's got this, slicked back hair and everything. And he's just like, oh, yes, please.
Yeah. And when she's wet in the rain, he offers her a towel.
He's a gentleman.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, that scene's great too because you don't see him. It's just this drawer slides
you see
out.
His legs, she's kind of.
Yeah.
It really is just like that perfect cocktail of things. Like the music. I mean, even when you compare the music to the next film, I mean, it's atmospheric and moody, and it just really takes you into that cold, kind of wet, dark place that you want to be in with a thriller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know the choice to do the POV shots where, like, really, as an audience member, you never feel like you're on the other side of the fourth wall, like you're inhabiting the characters. And it's just, I love this movie.
Yeah.
I can't believe how good it is 20 years later.
I know.
It's,
and the thing,
it's totally undated.
The thing that kind of shocked me too is I watched it Friday night and then Rachel hadn't watched
it. I know, I'm the worst. So, I'm sorry.
Anyway, so we watched it again the very next day, and I watched it all the way through just as invested as I had been the day before. And that was surprising. I thought, I'm going to be bored. I'm going to be, like, on my iPad, like, looking at stuff while we're watching this movie. And
no
I didn't.
Angry Birds
I was,
were played.
No, I was in it the whole time. And that surprised me. Because it's, and this isn't, like, the first two times I've ever seen this movie. I've seen it a million times before. Yeah, I mean, not for a number of years, but still.
Yeah.
So I was impressed by that.
I actually, I almost didn't rewatch it because I've seen it so many times and I thought I don't really need to. But I just got it on Blu-ray, actually, because the DVD that we have, this is shocking, I couldn't believe this. We have a single disc, bare bones, no special features edition of the DVD.
Oh my God.
I know. I was mortified. So I ran out on Saturday morning and picked up the Blu-ray. And I was really hoping there'd be a commentary on it, but there's not, unfortunately. But they have this thing called Breaking the Silence, which I assumed was a documentary, so I put it on. But it's like, it'll show the movie, but then it'll pop up with little facts and little clips of interviews and things. But it was actually quite distracting because it's not the whole of the movie. I mean, if they had something there the whole time, it would have been okay. But, you know, just these little snippets, and I'm like, oh, that's really jarring and quite irritating. But
I'll put video Silence of the Lambs style.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And this is so the movie you don't want interrupted. Like, you want to just be able to, like,
watch
focus.
It all the way through. Yeah.
I love it. You know, and I another way that I think deviates from the book that I think really worked in to the film's advantage is they changed her story a little bit. Her childhood and the silence of the, you know, the significance of the Silence of the Lambs has a lot more significance in the film than it does in the book.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. In the book, her father is Night's Watchman instead of a sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of a glorified sheriff because the town she's from is not glorified sheriff. That's not the right word, but he's sort of a default sheriff because the town's so small that he carries a weapon, but he's not actually a sheriff. And his mother, her mother is still alive and she has brothers and sisters. And so after he dies, the mother tries to keep the family together, but ultimately she can't. So she gets sent away to her aunt and uncles who has this sheep and horse farm, which they say in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But in the film, she actually is much more attached to the horses because all the horses are really old. And she realizes they're like the horses that are going to slaughter to like
the
glue
book,
factory.
I'm sorry, in the book.
They're going to the glue factory and yada, yada, yada. And she wakes up to the lamb screaming, but she doesn't save a lamb. She gets on her horse. But the horse is like kind of blind, and eventually they find her and take her back.
Interesting.
So they switched it to the film, and I think there is just even the mental picture of her running as a child, running through the forest with trying to hold a lamb is a much more evocative picture than her riding a blind horse.
Yeah. And the way Hannibal Lecter talks about the lambs crying, that she keeps hearing them, and do you think, you know, solving this case and saving this girl will silence them? It's
also the horse effective. Doesn't die. The horse, they end up keeping it, and she sees pictures later. She gets sent away to an orphanage, or she gets sent away to school as opposed to an orphanage, because in the film she's an orphan, which I think is again I think a better choice because she really has nothing in the world except for, you know, to use her you know capabilities to be the top of her class and really succeed, get the scholarships and do all the things that she does, and it really kind of helps to paint that picture of her, you know, the motivation for her ambition.
Mm-hmm.
and I think is a better way of informing the character, personally. That's my opinion. I mean, some people might be like, yay, go glue horse. That's fine. Right. Much better. But I just like the picture of her, you know, carrying the lamb, and that the lamb ended up getting sacrificed anyway, despite her trying to save it. Because then it goes back to her trying to save Catherine Martin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You understand she's trying to just save one. Like, that isn't really communicated in the book as effectively.
Yeah, and the way she describes it to Hannibal too, like, she does such a good job of, like, you see her in the moment all over again.
Yeah,
where she's trying to save the lamb.
So to sum up, Silence of the Lambs, fucking awesome. Everyone should see it if you haven't seen it, and if you have seen it, you should go back and revisit it.
Yes.
Do we have a consensus on this?
Yeah, that was my consensus. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
it still really holds up. It's a good film.
Yeah. We didn't really talk about the killer that much. I gather this film was criticized on release as being anti-gay. I just wondered what you guys thought about that because I heard in an interview with Ted Levine, who plays Buffalo Bill, that he never interpreted that Buffalo Bill was gay.
And I didn't either.
No, and that
I wasn't under the impression he was gay because there's pictures of him with like women on his lap.
Yeah,
because they make it seem like he had a relationship with the first woman he killed.
Yeah,
and Lecter talks about how he's like he's not a trans, really a transvestite. He just thinks he is because he wants to transform himself. So he's just like fucked up, you know. He's not gay. He's not a transvestite. He's not this or that. He's just like this messed up guy trying to change himself.
And
I think in terms of fine print, it definitely they cover their bases in terms of keeping it from preventing it from being something that could be really viewed as homophobic. But I mean, if we're going to talk about transgender representation in horror films, I mean, you saw Sleepaway Camp. I mean,
I didn't want to give that away.
Not fare well in horror films. You know, they just, the representation of them is never particularly flattering. And as much as we're all really, you know, tuned in as viewers and picking up on all the subtleties and when he's talking about the pathology of transgendered people, I don't know that a lot of the audience went away with that. You know, I think that moment, the visual of him with his penis and, you know, his business tucked between his legs is so powerful that it definitely overwhelms when you look back. And I think a lot of people associate him with being transgender as opposed to someone that is wrongfully identifying as transgender.
And possibly too, at the time that this was made,
not a lot of discourse about transgender people in 1991.
Do you think this was just a kind of a knee-jerk thing? Like people maybe even hadn't seen the movie and thought, you know, oh, it's about a guy who wants to be a woman, ergo he must be gay. Oh, and he's a serial killer, that's anti-gay. I mean, do you think it's just kind of a knee-jerk?
Possible.
Yeah.
I think that's a simplistic
way
of looking at it. Easy way to look at it. I don't think a lot of people spend a lot of time.
Right.
Really having, I think that's exactly the case. I don't think it's good representation of transgender people.
Sure.
But I, at the same time though,
I don't think it was intentionally bad. Either.
I also didn't get the, you know, like when you see stuff that's just like overtly, you know, transphobic and it just, you can feel in your gut that it's bad.
And
I don't get
wrong.
That feeling.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, not at all.
Well,
what about you, Sarah?
I'd never really thought about it.
Okay.
Word.
Okay.
Done.
Good. Because yeah, I mean, I guess maybe they were making a big deal of it in the movie because it was criticized more upon its release, perhaps. But I just thought it was interesting how the actor was saying that that's never how he played the character, and that you know, because they make a point in the movie that he doesn't have any, like the bodies that are found, they haven't been sexually abused or anything like that. But he very literally wants to be inside a woman. You know, he wants to tear a woman up and climb inside her. And he wants to kind of, you know, have the power that he feels that women embody or something like that, which, I don't know, I just thought that was really interesting. But it's also interesting that...
pathology is interesting.
Yeah, and it's more interesting that we don't... I mean, because it would have been kind of cringeworthy if we'd had a scene where he's kind of, I don't know, revealing, you know, like... You know, like doing the Bond villain thing, explaining to Catherine Martin,
right.
Oh, well, this is because my mother did this to me.
Oh my God. You
know.
Yeah,
thank
that would
God.
Have been awful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's much better that we just get glimpses of who he is and not a whole picture.
Yeah.
I think we could fill in the blanks pretty effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, the villain whose head we want to get into is Hannibal's. But the true villain of the piece, you know, like,
yeah.
There's enough with his character, like his MO, that you don't really need to get into his head for him to still be compelling.
Yeah, and it's from Starling.
And he is compelling.
Yeah, and the movie's from Starling's point of view, so we just know what she knows. So
right.
God, this movie's so good. I want to watch it again.
I know.
Awesome. Is there anything else you guys want to talk about? Silence of the Lambs before I move on?
No, just that Starling's awesome and she's resourceful. I mean, right at the beginning when she's trying to get into the storage locker thing and she's using her car jack to open the door, you know,
willing to crawl in and
she's doing the obstacle course at the start, you know, she's flipping over the rope ladder and stuff like that. And
can I just say that I love I already said this to Rachel, but she's like running in her sweats and she's like all sweaty and doing this course, but she has her little pearl earrings in and she wears them throughout the entire movie, I think.
She's great. I mean, she's just one of those, I mean, there's a reason that she is an iconic character. It's not just, I mean, the performance is incredible, but she's just such an identifiable character.
Yeah,
she's an aspirational character in a very realistic way, as opposed to like where we talk about Ripley being basically, I mean, like almost superhuman by the end of it. She's just, yeah, she's just this incredibly capable and yet flawed character that you really root for. Right.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up Ripley, because I was thinking about this movie compared with Alien, actually. And you take someone who should be considered vulnerable, like a woman, and put them in a situation where they have to sort of take charge and everything, which is really interesting. And also in the sense that you've got, like maybe this is reading way too much into it, but you've got the villain, or the perceived villain, which is Hannibal or the alien, but you've got the real villain, which is the company or Buffalo Bill,
right?
So you've got these sort of three elements. And there's a really good documentary that I watched called, I think it's called Inside the Labyrinth or something. It's a making of Silence of the Lambs. And they were talking about this story, comparing it to a fairy tale or a fable, and how Starling is this hero that sort of goes into the dark forest of evil to rescue a princess.
Interesting.
But, yeah, and that reminded me of Alien as well, in some Aliens specifically, actually going after Newt to rescue Newt.
Yeah,
so,
that's actually really interesting. Yeah. I kind of want to see this documentary.
Yeah, it's really good. I don't know how old it is, but
yeah, no, I mean this movie it's pretty great.
Yeah.
And Clarice is pretty great. These are my deep thoughts by Rachel Chateau.
Yeah.
But yeah. No. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think we're ready to move on to the crap. All right.
Now let's talk about how they ruin her. Okay. All right. So Hannibal, which is the, let's see here. Okay. So this is the 2001 sequel. So it's like a decade later to Silence of the Lambs. In this, it's been several years, I don't know if it's been the actual decade, but several years since Clarice Starling successfully apprehended Buffalo Bill, and Hannibal is still on the loose. And we open the film with the one surviving victim of Hannibal Lecter. The creepiest, most disturbing, most fire Marshal Bill looking dude ever, played by Gary Oldman. His name is Mason Berger, and he is this like rich pedophile who at a young age when he was still young and handsome, was
like
arrested for molesting children at his father's summer camp. And part of his treatment was to have Hannibal Lecter come in, and Hannibal Lecter, pretended to be into him, got him to get into some like autoerotic asphyxiation device and offered him a popper. And then, gently suggested that perhaps he should cut his own face off with some broken mirror.
Feed it to the dogs.
Feed it to the dogs.
And so he did.
And yeah. And okay. So
seems like a good idea at the time.
Yeah, that's such a great line.
I know.
I have to say, for as much as I, spoiler alert, did not like this movie, Gary Oldman was fantastic in it.
Yeah.
I mean, his performance, he just like chewed up the scenery like it was a dog eating his face. He was great. So anyway, so he's very revenge-minded, and he's using all of his resources to track down Hannibal Lecter. Meanwhile, Clarice Starling, who is now a full-fledged member of the FBI, she proceeds to, working with a police department, try to apprehend this, I guess, like a drug dealer. I don't know if they can really say who this woman is.
Yeah, she's like a drug dealer or something, and basically Clarice Starling's career falls apart because
of her. And so when it goes wrong, thanks to pesky men and their inability to control themselves.
Douchebag cop.
Douchebag cop. If the shooting goes wrong, her friend, in the book it's much more, he's actually a character from the first book, and it's really complicated. But anyways, a fellow FBI agent is shot in the process, hit by a car, and she ends up having to kill the woman while the woman is holding her child, which is really bad PR for the FBI. And it's the exact excuse that they've been using to by this guy, also a character cut from the movie, first movie, but is in the book, who has been trying to get rid of Clarice all along to kind of end her career politically. She's basically on the ropes with her career, and it becomes advantageous for Mason Verger to pull her in his quest to track down Hannibal by putting her in making her appear vulnerable so that it'll make him come out of hiding. But he's living this life of luxury, like I guess looking at old books in Venice, it's like the most boring.
Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting characters ever is
working. Yeah, he's trying to become a curator in Florence
or a library, curating a library.
Yeah,
or something.
I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, obviously it's a big deal, but still, like, really, this is where we have him. But you know, a police officer basically figures out that who he is and tries to apprehend him for the reward. It goes wrong. And so they frame Clary Starling. He comes out of hiding, returns to the United States. It is briefly captured and almost fed to pigs. And then he escapes with Clarice. Some romantic hijinks ensue. Pseudo-romantic hijinks ensue. And he escapes and feeds brains to a small child.
The end. The end.
Also, there's a lot of brain eating, which is pretty awesome. All right.
Country pussy.
Yeah.
Country pone pussy. A lot of country pone pussy talk. By the way, I gotta find a way to like work that into everyday conversation.
Country pone pussy.
Country pone pussy. All right. Who would like to go from there? Discuss.
Oh man, there's just so much wrong with this movie. It's hard to know where to begin.
Should we take it by character as opposed to plot point?
Sure.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Hannibal Lecter. Last time we saw Hannibal, he had escaped after chewing his way through the face of one guard and wearing the face of another. And very like poetically displaying one in a like a medieval sort of angelic pose, which was incredible at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Perhaps picking up on that thread of him having drawn pictures of Florence and having an affinity for medieval and Renaissance art. He's now, I don't know where I'm going with this, but he's now living in Florence. And, you know, last time we saw him, he was, like, going off to seek revenge and eat his therapist.
Yeah. And now he just seems to be, like...
Now we get shopping montages of him at, like, Zanzibars. What the fuck? Yeah.
It was kind of like an exaggerated version of, you know, because he's, like, a civilized guy. Like you say, he's into his art and his music and everything. So this is where he would probably live. But
right,
we don't need... Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, like, drinking in little coffee shops and things out of these little tiny Italian cups and things like that. And it's... I don't know. I just don't think we needed to see all that. It just kind of felt like the character of Hannibal in this movie feels like a caricature.
It totally does. And it's like, you already knew all of that about him. They didn't need to spend so much time shoving it in our faces, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
In the book, it has a little significance in that that's one of the ways that Clarice begins to try to track him down is she's looking at like receipts, trying, because she knows that he has this really incredible taste.
Right.
And so she's trying to, using like, I don't know, some sort of receipt matrix. I don't know. She starts trying to track him down based on purchases. So it kind of makes sense in the book. I mean, trust me, the book is garbage. But in the film, it makes even less sense.
And it's just, it's boring. And Lecter in the original movie is everything but boring. And somehow...
He's so mysterious. And they've replaced that with mundanity. Like, really? We need a shopping montage? Yes, nothing but the finest crystal for Hannibal Lecter. What the fuck?
Yeah, and it didn't seem to make sense to me either, because he's on the 10 most wanted list, and he's talked to Starling before about Florence. So you think maybe that would be one of the first places that they would look for him.
Exactly.
But why is it the first place that he... I mean, maybe he's been traveling around to lots of different places trying to avoid detection, but... Why would he be there in a place that he talked about?
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
But he has a fedora on now.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Everyone knows that you just put a fedora on and you're suddenly completely unrecognizable.
I think the thing that's like the most sort of disappointing about his character in this film, too, is that you get little glimmers of how he was in the original. Like, there's the scene where Potsy or whatever his name
Potsy?
Was. The Italian cop guy comes to his house and basically is picking up, you know, some stuff from a guy that he, you know, thinks Hannibal might have killed or something. And he's trying to get his fingerprints so that he can get the money for the reward. He has to prove that he has contact with Hannibal and knows where he is. So he's trying to convince him to do it. And you see that Lecter is understanding what's going on and then is kind of playing with him, the questions that he asks. And that part had a little bit it was a little bit more interesting than most of the scenes that Hannibal is in the rest of the movie. Like, it's a little bit more like the sort of cat and mouse stuff he does in the first one. Mm. But for the most part, he was either boring or, like you said, a total caricature.
Yeah.
You know, and we can talk later about what happens with him and Clarice that is, I just thought was ridiculous and ruined a lot of
it's
it.
It's like
for
they
me.
Took inspiration instead of from the quieter scenes where he's like having these intense dialogues with Clarice. They took the inspiration from the character from like his attack.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like him at a 10 is their sort of their baseline.
Right.
Yeah.
It was quite strange seeing him walk around because for the bulk of the first movie, he's behind bars. Mm-hmm. And it's only at the very end that you see him stand up and put on his hat and follow Chilton down that road on the island. So to have him in this movie, you know, just walking around doing his own thing was kind of weird to me.
Yeah, it was a little strange. And you got, I think, a little too much of him, too.
Like he's
you
know? Better in small doses.
Yeah. It lost
especially the way they portrayed him in this movie. He was better. He would have been better in small
right.
doses.
Yeah, because he's not mysterious anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like Hannibal Lecter : Hannibal takes a constitutional.
Right.
Hannibal
yeah.
Lecter.
Right.
Like what did I call it last night? The spaghetti somnolent or the spaghetti lullaby.
Yeah.
It's like the most I was having trouble keeping my eyes open. And it's interesting because it's the one film that I ever fell asleep during in a movie theater. And I just thought I was tired, like tired party girl, you know what I mean? But as an adult I'm watching, I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's like Take 2 hours in. And 15 minutes, and like so an hour of it is watching him sip things in cafes.
Right. Yeah, and that's what Rachel and I talked about, is like the beginning of the movie has some interesting parts with Gary Oldman and stuff, and then the end of it has some interesting stuff going on, but this whole 45-minute...
There's like a movie within the movie that
yeah, in Italy.
Cut.
It's like there's... You get the scenes of... You know, him drinking coffee and wine and boring stuff with the Italian police guy and going to the opera with his wife and stuff like that. And then you see Starling just being in a room, like looking at videotapes and pictures and basically doing no real detective work and nothing interesting. Yeah. And that takes up like 45 minutes of the film, and all of it is so mundane and boring. It's not electrifying, and it's not intense, and it's not suspenseful like the original movie was. I mean, in the original movie,
there's no momentum.
Yeah, after watching it so many times, I still just can't stop watching it, and I did not feel that about this one at all. And I remember when I saw it in the theaters when it first came out, I was so excited because I grew up loving Silence of the Lambs. Like, it had always been on the top of my list of, you know, great movies. And then, so I was so excited when I heard there was going to be a sequel. And when I saw it, I just remember walking out of the theater, like, disgusted and horribly, horribly disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that because I was too young to see this movie when it came out. The first movie when it came out, but Hannibal was it was rated 18. It's probably the first movie that I saw in the cinema rated 18, because I must have been maybe 16 or 17 when it came out, so I was quite excited to be able to go in to see, you know, a Silence of the Lambs movie on the big screen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, pretty upset when I came out, like, really, is that what 10 years later all this build up to this movie and that's what that's what we get? Really, it was kind of an injustice. But I mean, I wonder how much of it is because I gather that the book of Hannibal was written after the movie Silence of the Lambs came out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was written under some duress. Like, it was so popular. Okay, we need a sequel. Can you sort of...
Rachel has a bit of a theory about that.
Okay.
I think the first book was... I mean, it was written with... He had developed this character of Hannibal Lecter as this, you know, like this interesting side character. And what happened was the film Silence of the Lambs came out, and the Hannibal character was such a huge breakout star that he felt compelled to write a story around him.
Okay.
And he's when he took who was someone who was essentially ideal as a side character and tried to turn him into the focus of the film, there just isn't really enough meat there, or at least the way that he chose the direction he chose to take him in. So much of what's happening with the Hannibal character too is happening in internally. It's like the book. I mean, he's going on and on about it's when he's a child and, you know, his sister got eaten and yada yada yada.
Right,
but none of that translates to film.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also wonder, I mean, maybe a better author possibly or somebody else could have had Hannibal be a more central, maybe not like the main character, but like, you know, could have been Clarice and Hannibal in a movie, and it could have, or in a book, and it could have worked. But from what you've described and what I've seen in the movie, they just, I feel like both Clarice and Hannibal Lecter were just taken in directions so far away from the original.
It feels like fanfic. It feels like fan fiction to me. Right. Like they took, it's all wish fulfillment for people who loved Hannibal and wanted a romance.
Yeah, they wanted to do a Clarice slash Lecter.
Somehow, in the middle of it, he threw, like, you know, the first movie is this taut thriller, and then this one, it gets turned into this weird meandering clearance rack Roman Polanski film, and I'm like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Well, then, in the book too. I mean, then in the book too, you have a character that basically has no, that is, you know, like, spends like half a chapter in Silence of the Lambs, and in the movie has like 5 minutes of screen time, you know, that is the one that sees them and it, together in, at the end of the book in Buenos Aires, you know,
right?
You know, because they're discovered by Barney at the airport.
Okay.
Like, really?
Have you guys read the book at all? Anybody?
No, I haven't, but I've been looking into some of the differences between the book and film. But maybe you can. Yeah.
I mean, I wanted, like, I was listening to it, and I wanted a shower. It was so bad. It was
really?
So awful. Yes, the end is awful. We'll get to that, but it's so bad.
Ray Liotta, his character is just he's such a pig that, like, even when he's there, I mean, there's no sympathy for him, and that's the thing, is like, at least the other characters in Silence of the Lambs, there's sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I found that about Clarice in this movie too, that I didn't feel any humanity towards her at all, and it's kind of like she's been stripped of what made her an interesting character in the first one. Like, there's that bit at the beginning where she gets a letter from the Guinness Book of World Records because she's the female FBI agent that shot and killed the most people, and you think, oh, right, okay, that's what she is now. She's just, you know, this machine, and it's just not interesting at all now.
Yeah, she lost her vulnerability.
Yeah, and she's asleep on the way to the drug raid at the beginning as well. And
she's just not interesting.
There's
you don't care about anymore. Yeah, there's no vulnerability, and they could have had it where because of how the men treat her, or because of the hardship she's had in her career or in her personal life, that she's become hardened. And I think they were kind of trying to telegraph that a little bit in this film, but it didn't work, and I didn't feel for her.
She came off shrewish.
Yeah.
There's that line that somebody mentioned, I think it's Hannibal, he says, you know, you garnered the resentment of your husband and kids, and it's like, wait, where did those come from?
No, he said you gave up, like, the ability to have...
Yeah, that's what I thought he meant.
Wife
there. Like,
and kid.
Yeah, the chance to
not
have
that
kids,
she
yeah.
has a wife and kid that hate her, but that she gave up having them for her career, and now those people, you know, don't even want her in the FBI.
Yeah.
And
in the book, because you get a lot more of the internal dialogue, so much of her character is about her, like her rage over the fact that these men, including the guy, the Ray Liotta character, have actively pushed against her because she's a woman, and that because she hasn't been able to hold her tongue, that has prevented her from advancing in the career that she wanted to. And she's very, very bitter. Like, she's not been able to be in Jack Crawford's team because of this. And he's the only one, the only man that actually, there's two, the guy that dies in the first scene and Jack Crawford are the only two men that have supported her career. Mm-hmm. Everybody else has purposely kind of tried to push her down because they're either resentful of the fact that she is attractive or that simply she's a woman and she refuses to be put in her place. And you know, I can certainly identify with that feeling, but the way that it's portrayed, it makes her just seem bitter and resentful and kind of the worst of that scenario, whereas in the first film, she's up against the same kind of pressures, but she keeps this moral high ground by maintaining a level of professionalism that is admirable, and this has just been completely thrown out.
Right, where in this movie, in like three separate occasions, she like basically says, I'm going to speak out of turn now, and then just like lays on the table.
When I'm talking to you, I'll look at you.
Yeah,
that's how they'll know.
Exactly. And it's like,
fuck respects this person?
Yeah.
You've become the villain.
I like strong characters and I like a woman that can speak her mind, but it was getting to the level of, like bitter, shrew, and just completely unlikable. And you didn't want to see Clarice become that, really.
No, and the first movie was from her point of view, but this movie is just looking at her, not from within.
Exactly.
Her. So you don't get any of that. And also, I mean, I think one of the main problems people have with this movie, I think, is the casting. And I think the movie has problems that are much deeper than that anyway. But I think
can I chime in? And this morning when I was talking to you before we recorded, I was like, I need to call and wake up Sarah the most obnoxious way possible. And you're like, have Julianne Moore call her.
see, I like Julianne Moore. I mean, as far as like a list of like the top women, I think are like talented and super sexy. She's like in the top three.
Right. Yeah, and I think she did an okay job, and I think it is quite trendy to bash on Julianne Moore in this movie, but the problems, as I say, go much deeper than that. But also, I think she's quite good at playing a cold character that you don't really sort of sympathize with, and that isn't the character that we grew to love in the first movie. And while I guess it's kind of interesting that, okay, Starling, now she's this more hardened character, it's 10 years since the first one, she's, you know, a talented FBI agent now, it didn't suit the character being played in that way.
Right. Cold, and ball busting, bitter, successful women in pop culture and film are dime a dozen. Right. What made Clarice so interesting and appealing was that she had this level of capability without resorting to that, I'm sorry, but like that sort of male gaze of how, like, you know, the worst of ambitious women, the perception of ambitious women.
Yeah. I mean, part of the problem, too, is you're right. It's not just her acting, because, I mean, I think that just about anybody put in this role would have had issues just because of how the script is and everything. But they try, like, there's a scene in the beginning where right after she's had to kill the drug dealer and she lost that FBI guy that she, you know, was friends with and cared about. And she breaks down, you know, crying in her house. And I feel like it's like they were trying to show us some emotion, some vulnerability, but it just, that was the only glimpse you got of it throughout the whole movie. And the rest of the time she felt like, shrewd. Yeah. And really hollow.
Yeah. I definitely feel that as well. And I think even if they had managed to get Jodie Foster in this movie, I mean, that would have been just a very tiny plus. I don't think there's much more that she really could have done in this situation with this story.
I wonder if she could have brought some dimension, to the role, though, because it felt incredibly surface. Like, you know, when she was yelling at the people around her, you never got anything other than anger. Mm-hmm. Like, there were never conflicting sort of emotions. It didn't seem like she had any trouble talking out of turn. And that just doesn't fit with the Clarice Starling.
Right. And where Jodie Foster was so great is, like we talked about earlier, that you could see so much emotion on her face. And part of that is the point of view camera stuff where it was right up in her. But I mean, that's a mark of a good actress, that she was able to show you so much just by her facial expressions, you know, the way her hands moved, all of that kind of stuff. And I felt like with Julianne Moore, I didn't get any more than what was on the surface.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wonder if it would be maybe more of an insult if Jodie Foster was in this movie and the same things happened, you know, and the same story played out, if we would be even more insulted, like, I can't believe she agreed, you know, to play this character. And I gather that's why she didn't do it, because she didn't agree with what, you know, how the story played out. And they changed it a lot. But
in the officially, I think she said that she was working on this other movie, Flora Plume or Plum or something, which never came out.
The King, that one with the Anna and the King.
No, she was working on that too, but this one she was going to direct, and Claire Danes had like agreed to be in it or something like that.
Yeah.
So she was going to make this movie, and I don't think the movie ever came out. But then she said in a couple interviews that it was more that she felt like the book had really done an injustice to Clarice. Jesus.
Right.
And that the script was going to be the same way, and that she just wouldn't do that to that character.
Mm-hmm. Didn't Dino De Laurentiis, the producer, have some things to say about...
Yeah, like, you could probably look it up really quick, but he had some kind of nasty thing, or just rude things to say, and he kept in interviews calling her, like, Judy Foster on purpose.
Oh, right. Yeah, thing. I saw that, yeah. And wasn't it like they were saying,
like,
that
when somebody purposely says your name wrong, even though they know who you are, that's just an insult.
Yeah, and weren't they saying that she was saying that they wouldn't pay her enough or something? But
even when she was, like, in her little basement, pathetic basement office, like, looking through the clues and stuff, and
she was like the cop from Poughkeepsie Tapes that does nothing but watch the video.
Yeah. Right. It wasn't like with the first movie where you got to sort of see them putting the clues together, like you saw how Clarice was putting it together. You didn't really get that from this movie. They just sort of had a wall plastered with photos and crap all over her desk, and yeah, she jumped up when she saw him on the video buying that hand cream, but just wasn't a lot to it. And by the way, what was up with the slow-mo during that scene and a few others? They slowed it down and did the light trail thing, you know, where you could see her trail as she moved.
Yeah.
I was so confused by that, like why they added that in several places. Yeah.
Yeah, like when they did that when he cut the guy's neck in the museum.
And like in the first movie, the clues, like I was interested in all of it, but here with like the whole ambergris thing where they were like, talking to the perfume people, the experts, and you know, oh, what is this aroma and that, and oh, only a few stores sell this, and I was just like bored by that. It was a snooze fest, and I'm the type of person who actually, like, I watch police procedurals, and I, you know, when I got fascinated with serial killers, I used to watch, like, the crime channels that would show the documentaries about, you know, all the well-known and lesser-known serial killers. So I find that stuff interesting, like, how they track them down, and this just bored me to tears, you know?
Mm. Do you think it might be to do with the fact that there isn't a villain in the same way in this movie as there is with the first one? I mean, I guess Mason Verger is probably the villain in some ways, but it's not like
he's supposed to be the Buffalo Bill-like character, sort of the looming,
overarching
thing.
But he hasn't done anything, and we're not chasing him, and we're not trying to piece anything together as such.
We were talking about that last night, that there wasn't any sort of immediacy to it. Like, you didn't, in the first one,
their clock is ticking on Catherine Martin's life. And this one, I mean, you find him this week, you find him next week.
We know he's going to probably kill again, but it's not, there's nothing that's like, we have to find him right now.
Right, because they've been looking for him for 10 years.
Running against the clock.
Yeah. I will say there was more penis violence for having waited, though. Death by dick stabbing. That was like the most, I mean, with the exception of teeth, I think that might have been the most gruesome.
And God, wasn't that cop just such a jackass in that scene? I hated him. Like, where,
let me get the bracelet first.
Yeah, get the bracelet first. And then he pulls the guy's hand away and keeps his hand away so that he can't put pressure on his wound so that he bleeds out faster. I was like, wow.
Mm.
This actually brings up something interesting. I think, and it's something that's throughout the entire film, is they never flesh out the motivation, flesh out the motivations for anybody in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is Clarice so bitter? We don't really know. I mean, we can put two and two together. I guess Hannibal, whatever. But why is this cop why is he willing? He's a cop. Why is he so unwilling to involve the police in this? I mean, why is he so greedy? Is it just because his wife wants to go to more operas?
Mm. Right. And so he needs all this money.
They explain it in the book, but they hint at it a little bit in the film, but they never really give you a reason for why he would do this and put his life in danger and go against who he is as a police officer. I mean,
and being willing to basically, like, shorten this man's life, not save him, just so he can get this piece of evidence and get the,
why,
like, he's a cop, why
killed?
You know, and they kind of show in the beginning that he's been disgraced a bit or something, where he wasn't allowed to be on this case. They don't really explain it enough, and his wife, you know, sort of likes the finer things, and you know, cops probably don't make that much money, and so,
but to the point where he would let some dude bleed out from the crotch.
I know,
and then it carries on, like, I mean, why, I mean, yes, obviously Ray Liotta is like a yucky frat boy, but at the same time, like, really to the point where he suffers the fate he does, like, how are we supposed to feel about it? Is he the villain? Are we on Hannibal's side? Are we horrified? Like, you can't really come down on one side or the other with him, because he's not a clear villain, he's not a clear,
he's just an asshole.
Right,
exactly.
I mean, it's not that, you know, I don't mind complexity. I like complexity, but there's no nuance. Like, it just feels like, huh? But the worst, the most egregious example of this is the guy at the end that pushes Old Man Over the Edge, you're like,
right.
Wait, what? He has a problem with this? Like,
yeah.
Where did this, I mean, it came out of nowhere. The whole, like, they wrote themselves into a corner.
Yeah, the whole movie, he's been willing to do everything this guy wants, and he knows what the ending is going to be. He knows that these pigs are being bred to, you know, slowly kill Hannibal Lecter. He knows this is the plan. He says in one sentence, like, I'd rather not watch, you know, kind of
yeah.
for entertainment or whatever. And that's, and he says, you know, he basically tells him that he has to. But to be willing then to do to this guy what they were going to
watch,
what he doesn't want to watch them do to Hannibal is like, what the F? And
watching's too far. Pushing someone in to die, that I can do.
And if he had been so disgusted with the guy as a person, like, he was a pedophile, he molested these boys, now he's trying to, you know, now he's manipulating Starling and possibly
there's
willing
no
to get her killed.
Of a problem
so,
earlier on.
But he doesn't leave. He could have left, right? They don't make it seem, like, they could have said, well, he knows something about his past, and so he's being blackmailed into doing this job, and he is absolutely disgusted with it, and that's why when Hannibal gives him a way out, he's willing to kill him. I mean, what would that have taken? Maybe 2 minutes of screen time to tell us that? And they don't. They give no reason.
They've opted for shock value over, like, motivation.
Yeah, exactly.
They keep giving, I mean, because you don't, having, and I've watched it, like, trying to be sort of with a critical eye, but, you know, the first time I saw it, I just walked away with, like, moments, like, snapshots, mental snapshots mm-hmm. of, like, the brain and the pigs eating human flesh and things like that.
And him throwing, you know, string or hanging the guy and cutting his guts right. fall out on the sidewalk.
But it's like, and that's what I mean by it. It's just so ham-fisted. It's just like, they don't expect you to, they make these logic leaps that as an audience, it's kind of hard to get on board ever because you don't know how to feel about the characters. You don't understand the characters.
And what we were talking about in Silence of the Lambs that was great is that there really isn't a ton of violence that you see all of. Like, even, you know, when Hannibal kills the cops, you see him kind of eat at the guy's face a little bit, but you don't see him, like, rip the guy's face off. You don't see him actually cut the guy's, that other guy's face off and put it on his own. He goes out there with the knife, and it's so creepy the way he's like, are you ready for me or something? You know, all of that is, it's creepy and it's tension filled and you know, but this movie shows you everything and it's way less effective at creeping you out. It's
like,
just sort of,
which one is more like creepy and disturbing in hindsight, the guy with his guts spilling out on the palazzo or the quick pan past the woman's suit on the dress form in Silence?
Definitely. I think you're right. This movie does try and show you too much. Whereas in the first movie, we get little hints that Lecter is very civilized. You know, he mentions wine and everything and fava beans. And that's all you need to know that he's a civilized guy and he likes the finer things.
Exactly.
But then, you know, oh, now he's living in Florence and going to the opera and he's a curator of this museum or whatever. And it's just too much. And also, like you said about Starling's character, yeah, she's bitter and she's shouting and now she's angry. And it's just feeding you instead of letting you, you know, get all this, you know, nuance and everything like the first movie
did. Condescending to the audience that we couldn't figure it out if they don't just, like, hit us over the head with all this information.
Yeah. It makes me sad that Ridley Scott is responsible for this film.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, the thing that drives me nuts, too, is, like, during the whole film, up until he goes on his, like, little killing spree, Lecter is very careful about not touching anything, not leaving his fingerprints, not leaving his lip prints.
Yeah.
And then it's like his prints are all over everything once he kills those three guys.
He touches everything.
His prints are all over Ray Liotta's cabin. You know, it's
Why also was he, like, all of a sudden started just handing stuff out from his curated library collection?
I know. He's like, here, actually I found his. This priceless artifect.
And I can give you the picture of your, you know, relative.
And did we really have to sit through part of that opera? Really?
I know.
I mean, just
the costumes were kind of cool, but it wasn't
worth
watching. But we could have trimmed this bloated running time by cutting out just a few of these scenes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it would have been a better movie for it.
Yeah, definitely.
Loaded. That's the best word I can think of for this.
Actually, I think there's a fan edit out there that is...
completely cuts out Florence. Hope.
Well, that tightens up the story.
That's what Rachel was asking for last night. She's like, I don't want to watch it.
Well, I don't think that... I mean, the whole purpose of Florence is so that you can see how the pieces all come together. Unlike where you have this clear trajectory of where you're solving trying to beat the clock and find this killer before the time runs out. This one is all about taking disparate characters and bringing them together, mm-hmm. right?
In a very meandering way.
This Florence section is totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
Clarice could have, I mean, they have the mechanism for how she finds him in the book. They could have had her track him down and, you know what I mean? She could have even flown to Florence and tried to catch him and then gone home. And we wouldn't have had to have anything with the stupid corrupt police officer or all of the like furniture shopping, which by the way, if like, what was with the furniture shopping if he was going to Ray Liotta's house? I mean, it was fully furnished.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, just all that stuff to me, it's self-indulgent. It's like, why do we need, I mean, I know they're trying to juxtapose his like refined taste with the best of the crystal and the best lamps and whatnot versus the grisly like implements of cutting people's heads off that he stole from the morgue or whatever.
Yeah.
But it, to me, it just feels like, okay, let's go. Come on, pick up the piece.
Get past this. Let's get to the next.
I mean, scene. I might even be more forgiving of moments like that if there weren't 15 of them.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
So, okay, what other characters should we talk about? Should we talk a little bit more about Gary Oldman, my favorite character in the movie? His makeup in this is so amazing. It's so creepy. The skin grafts on his face and the milky eyes.
Yeah, they're always watery. And the way he, when he talks and, like, the way his mouth moves and his lips move. And then the way he has to, like, sip the wine through a straw.
Gross.
Oh, you know? My God. He's the grodiest.
Yeah.
And so, his icky ponytail.
Yes. And everything about that character is totally changed from how it is in the book. From the way, who kills him, the way he dies, his appearance, the fact that he's able to get around at all. None of that.
In the book, isn't he kept in like a hyperbolic chamber because he doesn't have the skin grafts? It's just, he's like a Two-Face in the new Batman.
Yeah, kind of. Like he has no like lips or anything like that.
So he's on a respirator.
So he has a very like patterned way of speaking because he can only speak when, you know, with the respirator. Oh, sorry. There's some cat on cat love happening over here. Oh. Usual face licking. Very exciting. Do you guys want to hear a little bit about how it differs from the book, or is that interesting or not?
I thought it was interesting. If you don't, when you listen to it, you can always edit it out. But I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, okay. I'm interested to hear. Yeah,
really briefly, and it addresses my big beef with him, the way that he is disposed of at the end, where he's dropped into the pit.
Mm-hmm.
We need to talk about the end of this movie. Do you want to do that first? Let's talk a little bit about the end of the movie, and then I'll tell you how it's different in the book.
Okay.
So once Hannibal's made it back to the United States, there's like a little, and this is one of the brief moments where the movie was kind of clicking for me, where he's playing a little cat and mouse with Clarice, where she's following him based on the sounds through the phone, through this, you know, really populated mall area. And he's like behind her and he like touches her hair as he goes by on the carousel and she doesn't see him. And I thought that part was really interesting because even though she's now been dismissed pretty much or she's on leave,
She's suspended. Had her weapon and her badge.
She's still at her core. She's still an FBI agent. She can't just let it go. So she starts trying to track him down. And he gets scooped up by the Verger's cronies, I guess, the guys that have been especially raising these hogs to eat human flesh and brought back to, whatever compound where they've got these pigs. And, they've got him like strapped to a cross. While they remember, he's like tied to a cross, and cue the pigs by playing like people screaming. Which I thought, I mean, like there's some great ideas in here.
Mm-hmm.
So Clarice gets there in time, rescues him, but the pigs swarm in, and I don't know, it's like that moment in Chronicles of Riddick where the dogs don't attack Riddick because it's an animal thing.
Right.
Like they attack all the bad guys except for they just like let barefoot Hannibal, who's like carrying Clarice, who's been shot in the shoulder,
that was the
pigs.
Worst scene. Like, it was like, what is that, like from An Officer and a Gentleman or something, where he carries her out of the
paper factory?
It was awful. I was like, oh my God. So instead of just running out, which I can understand that he wouldn't just run out, he wouldn't just leave her to die. I sort of can get that.
But she's did we really need Clarice shot? Did he really have to be the hero?
No. And did he really have to carry her in that loving manner? You know, it was just a little ridiculous. And again, it's playing into that whole like bit of chemistry that we saw in the beginning instead of in the first one, instead of just sort of having that electricity between them, now we have this like ridiculous romance.
Yeah, know? It turns into a weird, well, disturbing romance novel.
Yeah.
Like at the cabin or the lake house when he's like, you know, did you ever once tell me that if I loved you, I'd stop killing? And she's like,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, where's this coming from?
Yeah.
What's going on here?
And then she says like, no, I never would. And he's like, that's my girl or something.
It's which, yeah.
Believe it or not, is so much better than the way the book ends. so I'm like, thank you, God. Hold on, I'm trying to get a picture of my cats to send you.
Yeah, because I understand the book ends with
yes,
like him hypnotizing her and digging up her father's bones and
yes,
yeah,
right, yes. Really.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, so he rescues her, he takes her back to this place and nurses her back to health, and she kind of wakes up in a drug stupor and she's in a designer gown now.
Yeah, with her boobies, you know, all nice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, looking good.
Very nice.
Ladies are looking good. And she stumbles downstairs to discover that Hannibal has laid out like a little feast for her and their guest, Ray Liotta.
Who has a hat on and is looking like he's maybe drunk.
Looking a little dumb.
Yeah.
A little stupid. And he's saying all these like ridiculous, horrible, sexist, misogynistic things at her.
Yeah.
Because I mean, they're like really going for the gusto at the end. They're like, okay, we gotta hurry up and make this guy a villain. We haven't really.
Right. And
make
him be rude. Damn it. He's rude. Okay. And that's why Lecter is killing him, because he's a rude.
He's a free range rude eater.
Yeah.
That is funny. That's I mean, there's like moments of funniness in this movie. Okay. So, you know, he removes the hat and then pries. I love this, where he pries the top of Ray Liotta's head off.
Yeah, and you just see the brain sticking out.
And proceeds to remove the protective wrapping off his head and then starts cooking and feeding his brains to him.
And Ray Liotta's like, ooh, that
it's
smells
so
good.
It's so hard for me to hate a movie that features this scene.
I know. And it's like, that scene, you know, is a little bit cringe-inducing, you know, to watch it, but... You really, in a lot of movies that have like torture in them and stuff, it sticks with me for a while after the movie. This one I felt like it didn't at all, because they didn't really care about any of it.
No, I thought that brain looked pretty good. He's frying up.
Well, I love the way it cooked up.
Yeah, it's a brain right now. It looked good.
Yeah. Sweet bread.
Then I cut sweet bread for nothing. So this is the problem, is there's 15 minutes at the beginning of this movie and 15 minutes at the end of the movie that I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I don't like that they're going a romantic angle with Clarice and Anthony and Hannibal, I did enjoy the interaction between the two of them,
mm-hmm.
where he's like fighting with her and he like closes her hair into the refrigerator and breaks off the handle. And they're having this. Again, it's that intense dialogue that made the first film, I mean, much better done in the first film, but made that dynamic so interesting. They're like returning to that kind of verbal cat and mouse.
Right. It's a little clumsier, but it's still there. And so you're intrigued by it. You want to watch that part.
And her character stays true to her character when he's kissing her. Like, he's dominating her. And that's the thing is, I think it's very, it's supposed to be romantic, but it comes across very villainous to me.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, like forcing himself on her, kissing her. And she claps the handcuffs around his hand and, you know, he has to cut one of their hands off. I did like that when he's like above the cuff or below the cuff.
I did too. And then you see her scream but he gets cut his own. You find out that he cut his own hand off, not hers.
Which, that's great. He ends up on a plane and he gets away. Yeah.
Great. What did you think about him feeding the brain to like the little kid on the plane?
I liked that.
I thought it was kind of cool, but a little bit caricaturish, you know, too cartoony almost.
Yeah, but I don't know. Here's the thing is it was sort of that dialed up version of the final act of Silence of the Lambs,
right?
Where you were like, oh yeah, he's this.
There's a little pun and
it also made Hannibal kind of feel a little bit more like Hannibal in that moment, sort of like the wordplay that's kind of happening.
Yeah, and devious. I can see that.
But still, the final, that final beat of Silence of the Lambs where she's like, Dr. Lecter, Dr. Lecter.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you can't beat that. That's such a great way to end the film, especially as a standalone film. It didn't need a sequel. Like, as a standalone film, like, you like Hannibal, even though he's a bad guy, and he's off, like, doing his thing, and it's left to your imagination where he goes, and Clarice is graduated, and it's like, everybody's kind of left where they need to be. I don't know that we needed a sequel.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. It was just nice to wonder what would happen. You know, Lecter walks off into the sunset, you know, chasing after Chill, and you think, oh, what's gonna, like, you know, she's calling after him on the phone, and you think, oh shit, is she gonna try and go after him, is she gonna let him go? And you don't need to see what ensues after that.
Yeah, you don't need to know. That's why we have imaginations.
Yes. I didn't like this movie very much either. I do like some elements of it. I mean, I think some of the settings are really nice, and I don't mind the Florence parts. I mean, they don't fit in this story really, right, in this universe. Yeah. I mean, in another movie that would look gorgeous, you know, and it would look really nice, and the score and everything. Right. But it was just so jarring comparing this to the first movie. It's just completely different. And what I liked about the first movie in terms of the score was that it didn't always feel like music. It felt kind of just like noise, like machines kind of in the background. And it wasn't like, bum, 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 dramatic reveal. I mean, there was some dramatic music at the end, but it didn't dictate how you should feel about things. Like when you meet Hannibal for the first time, it's completely quiet. There's no like, bum, 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 this is a villain. Ooh, oh, this is a triumphant moment. This is a sad moment. You didn't get any of that, but you do in the second one. And it's just dictating to you the same as they're feeding you all this stuff about Hannibal's tastes and everything, and how
again, it's like Rachel said, it's ham-fisted, it's
clumpy,
you know, exactly. It's not done with any finesse.
There's no mood to the second film either that the score really does a good job of creating.
What did you guys think of Barney in the second movie, him like selling off
he felt unnecessary
stuff?
Like, what is he even doing in this movie?
I didn't like it at all, because you got the sense that there was, I mean, he talks to Starling in the second one about he's got this respect for Lecter, and like he knew that Lecter would never come after him because they respected each other and he was civil to him. But then he's selling off all his shit, like, making all this money for shit, and it's...
I kind of wondered if they put him in the movie just because people liked him from the first movie. Like, I really liked him in the first movie. Oh, okay, he's in the book, too.
Yeah.
But
he actually has a purpose, more of a purpose.
But in the first one, it's like...
And I also didn't need all the extra details and the recut versions of their conversation.
Oh, yeah, I know, with
Julianne Moore's voiceover,
That was bad. And... Yeah, and Barney in the first one, it's like you just see sort of little glimmers of him, and you see... Is everything okay?
Yeah, no, everything's fine.
Okay. You see... What was I going to say? Oh, what's the bad psychiatrist's name? Chilton. When he's, you know, sort of toying with Lecter and has him all locked up with the cage over his face.
That cage is awesome.
It is really awesome. It squishes his nose.
I had forgotten that.
You can see, like, Barney's uncomfortable with it, and he doesn't really want this to be going on. You just sort of get a glimpse of him being a good guy, and that's probably why, you know, he survived so long around Lecter. And in this one, again, they just, like... shove that information down your throat.
By the way, they had conversations. They were friends. He's not a villain.
Yeah,
like
they
Hilton.
Stayed up nights talking to each other.
Yeah. All right. So, okay, shall we talk a little bit about the difference?
Yeah, why don't you tell us about the ending?
Okay, so, I mean, okay. The biggest difference is the story, the plot line with Verger. Instead of having like a little weird sidekick that you don't really understand why he is doing these things for him, if he doesn't, you know, agree with him, it's his sister. He has a sister who he sexually abused as a child, who Hannibal was the therapist for both of them. And as a child told her, you know, cause he'd been like raping and sodomizing her, that, you know, don't worry, someday, you know, you could always kill him. Just make sure you wait until you can get away with it. And that was something that she took a lot of solace in. But the reason she's going along with the stuff that her brother is doing, who, by the way, in the book is introduced, like Clarice goes to the house, and when she gets there, there's like a room with like children that have been bussed in from the inner city to play with toys or that he can watch on a video feed.
So creepy. Huh.
Yeah. So the reason she's willing to go along with this is that, she's now a lesbian, and she wants her partner to be able to carry on the line of the family, because it's like this prestigious family, and he keeps kind of holding the promise of giving her sperm over her head, right? And so when Cannibal or when Hannibal gets captured, there's a scene between her and him where they're talking and he's like, you know, you could kill him. This is your chance and say that I did it. I would even call and leave a message confessing to the crime so no one would ever suspect you. You know, you don't need his permission to get his sperm. A cattle rod would work just as well as, you know, she kind of considers it. But at the last minute, she's like, no, I've already got a plan in place and leaves him to die. But what happens is when Clarice and him get away, she gets shot with a dart gun and he takes off with her. The sister has her opportunity to kill him. She goes in there. He refuses to give her sperm, so she sticks a cattle rod up his ass, takes the sperm, and then shoves an eel down his throat to kill him.
Huh.
So you get a shot of the eel in the movie, and I was like, I wonder if we're gonna see that, how that goes down, but the sister never showed up. And then Hannibal keeps to his promise and, you know, gets her off the hook by leaving a message claiming responsibility for killing him. But what really deviates is the ending in which instead of her waking up drug induced and, you know, still being an FBI agent, he uses hypnotic drugs to slowly manipulate her and like goes through all this therapy with her, brainwashes her, digs up her father's bones and like leaves from the room to come to terms with the fact that he's dead. In addition to trying to make space in her psyche for his dead sister, because there's a whole backstory about when he was a child and these soldiers came in and, started eating the children. They were starving, and so they started eating the children, including his sister. And so he's trying to like make room in her psyche for his sister. And they go downstairs and they eat the guy's brain. And
does Clarice eat the brain too?
I can't remember if Clarice eats the brain, but she's not in no way. She's like watching it detached. She's very detached, and she's just sort of watching it all unfold. And like, there's this whole thing about breastfeeding, and she ends up like exposing her breast and drizzling wine on her nipple for him to drink off her nipples. And that's how they end up hooking up. And then they like run off to Argentina together.
So ridiculous.
It was
what
very
was
upsetting.
He thinking? The author, like,
there's this whole like him like suckling at her nipple like his mother. I'm just like, ugh.
Really?
Ew.
Grief.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, so that's how how Hannibal ends. What are your thoughts? Now, from that perspective, looking back at the rewrites of the end of Hannibal, what do you think of the movie?
Well, they did a much better job. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to see Hannibal and her, like, sleeping together and suckling stuff and all that.
Just thinking about Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster. Like, is there any world in which that scene would make sense with those two characters?
No.
No.
If they were different characters, but
well,
no.
That's what
not
I'm
with
saying.
These
like,
characters.
But I mean, as performed by Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins, that those two would hook up.
No, not at all.
That it would end with like some pseudo breastfeeding action.
And okay, so from the first movie, I can't imagine going to the end of the second book. But from the first book, does it make sense going to the end of the second?
No.
Book? Yeah.
I personally didn't think so. I obviously that's not where I wanted the story to go, but it wasn't even, I mean, it was in order. Here's the thing. This is why I think it's like, I'm calling like shenanigans is because even in this world that Thomas Harris has created where he wants to get from point A to point B, he had to brainwash his character
to get it to
through
happen.
Use of hypnotic drugs and, you know, super Anthony Hopkins powers where he can make people swallow their own tongues. Like it took all of that
cut off
to get,
faces.
Get, you know, Clarice Starling of, you know, cheap shoes and good bag fame to like nipple suckling at the end.
Oh, it's so
so that's why I'm like shenanigans everywhere, all over the place.
Yeah. So Hannibal sucks.
Yes.
In short.
Yes. That's my capsule review.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like the problems are very deeply rooted in the fact that the book was even written, I think. I mean, it has a good cast, you know. I mean, it's not badly acted, I guess. And, you know, there's a competent director behind it. It's just, you know, I guess maybe it has some of the right ingredients, but it just doesn't come off. But it's before the movie was even made that there were problems.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can necessarily blame Ridley Scott or Julianne Moore or, you know, the screenwriters or anything like that. It's just a movie that shouldn't have happened and a story that didn't need to be told. That's my opinion.
It doesn't help to have basically a Dan Brown novel in the middle of your novel either. I just kept waiting for Tom Hanks to jump on screen and be like, the signs, the symbols, we have to save the Vatican.
Oh,
but that's just me.
All right, so Clarice in the first movie, awesome. Clarice in the second movie,
I don't feel like they're the same character. I think they share the same name and the same job title. That's it. I don't feel that they're the same person.
I even think to a lesser degree, but still, I think the same thing is true with Hannibal.
And it's crazy to watch this, and after having just recently seen Game Change, and just like, Julianne Moore is capable of so much more. Did either of you guys see Game Change, where she plays Sarah Palin?
No,
not yet.
Holy shit. It's uncanny. So I guess we'll forgive her for Hannibal. Although this was during like the phase of her career where she was like the franchise killer. Because do you remember she was also brought in for the second Jurassic Park film?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
This is like not a good time for Julianne. Which, have you guys revisited those movies recently?
The Jurassic Park?
Yeah. The first one I saw again.
I think the third one gets a bad rap. I actually like the third one.
Is the third one where it's like the dinosaurs come to home?
No, that's the second one. That's the Julianne Moore
vehicle. Yeah, that one wasn't good.
The third one's the one where they go back to the island because the kid has gone missing.
Yeah, that one is pretty good.
And there's like pterodactyl action.
Yeah, I remember thinking that was like entertaining.
Yeah.
I saw the first one in the theater and I don't think I've seen him since, other than like occasionally when one shows up on TNT, I happen to catch it like 10 minutes of it, and then commercial break happens and I change the channel.
Well, I definitely recommend you treat the second one that way. All right, so
should
we move on? We have a ton of listener feedback, but I think maybe should we save it for the next episode, because we're already like really running long.
Yeah, we're going pretty long. Yeah.
And so now that we have tackled Silence of the Lambs and its sad inbred cousin, I want to move on to
My name's Hannibal.
It's like Tucker and Dale's unfunny cousin. So, okay. Let's talk. We have a new segment. This one's going to be led by Miss Explody. You want to take us through this new segment?
Yeah, sure. This is ZGBG, Zombie Girls Beginner's Guide.
I like that. Nice.
Although I shouldn't say Z, I should say Z. I feel dirty saying Z, but anyway, so this is an idea I had ages ago, and I was gonna maybe do it as a separate podcast, but I don't know enough to have it on its own as its own thing, so I thought I'd donate it to Zombie Girls, because I thought, well, what if someone who wasn't a horror fan, you know, hypothetical situation, okay, I want to get into horror but I don't know where to start, help me out, you know, so we'll pick various subgenres or aspects of horror, and then we'll come up with a little beginner's guide to that particular aspect of horror. Does that make sense?
Yep, great idea.
Excellent. So and I guess because of the nature of the podcast, we're going to start with the idea of the final girl. So beginner's guide to final girl. So what if, you know, hypothetically someone says, okay, I don't know what a final girl is, explain to me or give me some examples. So we're going to pick each three movies or three examples or three franchises or three people that we think are good examples or exemplify the archetype of the final girl.
Awesome.
Makes sense?
Yes, sounds great.
Excellent. Okay. So... Yeah,
why don't you kick us off so we can follow your lead?
Okay, and I imagine there'll probably be some overlap, and that's fine. And maybe this could be put on the website or something. It could be a page on the website where we have a list or something, or, you know, top three or whatever. I tried to maybe not go for the obvious ones, but I was explaining to Rachel earlier that there are different ways that you could pick this. You could pick most famous ones, or, you know, three original ones, or your three favorites or whatever. So there's no, I'm not going to set any criteria. It's just whatever you feel, you think, you know, for whatever reasons you want to pick the three that you have. So I've just gone for my personal favorites.
Awesome.
First one, kind of obvious, but I think a very good example is Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I think she is.
Remake, right?
Negative. Heather Langenkamp. So she's, you know, she's intelligent, she's resourceful, and she's awesome, and she outwits the killer. Similarly, Ginny from Friday the 13th Part 2.
See, that's one of my picks. I absolutely love Jenny.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, she's smart. She's strong. She, you know, doesn't play the victim.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So I think she's a definitely strong example. And finally, Sue from Carrie.
Yeah. I thought of that one.
That's
yeah. Great. Yeah. Well, because she's, you know, she's a nice, kind-hearted character, and she just wants to do right, and you know, she's rewarded by, I guess, surviving at the end of the movie. I mean, maybe she's traumatized by nightmares at the end of the movie, but you know, she's a survivor girl, and she does the right thing by Carrie. So she's awesome. a nice character. So
I always forget about her. I just remember, they're all going to laugh at you.
Yeah.
Dirty pillows.
Yeah. Have you seen there's a remake on the way?
Oh,
yes.
I think, is it Chloe Moritz is going to be Carrie?
Really?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
I think that could be interesting.
Yeah.
Although I'm a little disturbed because she was like, you know, hit girl, and she's like this cute little girl. I don't really want to think about people shouting, plug it up! And yeah.
Didn't they do a remake of it?
I thought they did
a sequel.
Oh, that's right. Carrie, yeah.
Carrie 2.
That's right.
Yeah,
how
Carrie's
could you forget that fine cinematic moment?
Wow. Yeah. I thought they did maybe like a straight-to-TV miniseries remake or something like that, but I don't
they
think
they might have.
Yeah.
Now that you say that sounds... You know what? I think... Wait. Which is the one that has the girl from May in it? What's her name?
Angela
Bettis.
Bettis.
Yeah.
So who wants to go next?
I can go next. All right, so I picked my final girls. I tried to pick like a variety, you know, like different ways that they represent sort of this trope. The first one I picked is sort of like a classic final girl, which is Sally Hardesty from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
It's
not necessarily the strongest character, but she can run the fastest.
Right.
Survive like a family of scary cannibals.
Sure.
And she has sort of that iconic closing shot of her in the back seat or in the back of the
truck. Yeah.
So she's to me like a classic survivor girl, but before the trope really kind of had evolved into what it represents today. Mm-hmm. The second one I picked was Sarah from The Descent, who she's sort of the opposite of Sally, where she survives based on her strength and on ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
Like she has the luck of not getting picked off early, but at the same time, she's able to kind of fight her way through, and that's how she earns her position as the final girl.
Right.
So that's why I picked her.
You have a different ending to The Descent than I do.
Right. We had the American ending.
Sure.
there's a
yeah, we talked about that a little bit. Remember it ends with her, like, in the dark?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Maybe she's not a very good survivor girl in that case. Oh, too late. I can't think of another one.
No, sorry. You can cut that out.
No, you're totally right to point that out. She isn't really the survivor girl, is she?
But okay. She is the final one. I mean...
All right. American cut. The
sure.
Descent. And then the last one I picked, because I feel like it's a really great, it's almost like a good primer for the survivor girl is Behind the Mask, the Rise of Leslie Vernon, the Taylor Gentry, because that whole film is about taking that slasher genre, which is really what this survivor girl is synonymous for, is that last girl,
right.
And kind of dissecting it and discussing it in sort of an interesting parody format. Mm-hmm. So like if you're not quite figuring out what it takes to be a survivor girl, it takes you through step by step the characteristics that you need to have and how you go to become one and ultimately what you need to do to be the ultimate survivor girl.
Right.
Nice.
I love that movie. I know, Sarah, don't you hate that movie?
I don't like it. I know a lot of people think it's wonderful and I don't like it.
Fair enough.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, I totally recommend it.
Okay, cool.
See, are you Team Rachel or are you Team Sarah? The podcast divide.
Yeah, it's on my Netflix queue too.
I think we should do it, even though I know Sarah, you're not a big fan, but you can.
I'm willing to watch it again. I mean, if on a second viewing it changes my mind, then great. But I mean, honestly, I thought it was kind of slow-paced. I thought it took forever to get to where it was supposed to be. And once it got there, it was like, okay, fine. You're there. Now what?
I really want to do that very soon.
Okay.
That'll be fun.
Okay.
All Okay, so I picked Sydney Prescott from, well, basically all of the Scream movies.
Good one. Good choice.
Always the last one. And that one, again, Nev talks Campbell about... Yeah, this one, in those movies, especially, like, the first one talks, and the last one talks so much about, like, the rules of horror movies, okay. including the final girl. And then I almost wasn't going to pick this just because I thought somebody else would, but... Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween.
Of course.
Or, yeah. Oh, geez. She also plays Kim in Prom Night, and she's the final girl there.
Right,
and
right. Terror Train.
At the end.
Yeah.
Terror Train, there's a guy that survives, too.
She's the final girl.
Did the guy kill the bad guy in the end of Terror Train? Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't remember.
Spoiler alert. No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry. Well, you know the bad guy's probably going to get it. But anyways, and then the last one, I actually picked... Alice from the first Friday the 13th
movie. She's a great one.
Yeah.
I mean, she has a bad time in the boat.
Yeah.
She's still the final girl, though.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
So those were mine.
Cool.
Awesome.
Sarah?
Okay, well, my first one is Christy Cotton.
Oh, from
the Hellraiser series.
Cool.
Nice!
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she manages to outsmart Pinhead twice. The first time, just totally unknowingly. The second time, and actually the third time, because she appears in one of the later Hellraiser movies, she does something that you're just like, wow, what a bitch. That's awesome. Like I said, Ginny from Friday the 13th Part 2. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, like we discussed, she's tough, she's smart, she, you know, she puts on that nasty, nasty sweater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tries to use her mind to defeat Jason. And I know Rachel's going to cringe at this one.
Oh, no!
But White Girl from Freeway 2. I just love the character, especially at the end when she's got the pistol and she's like, I'm a messenger of God, bitch.
Well, at least it wasn't Cyclona. I can kind of go there with you with White Girl.
In my next life, I have wings.
Has anybody else seen Freeway 2?
I have.
No. Oh, good
Lord. Oh, God. Good Lord.
That movie is a trip. It's... Yeah.
Is there a Freeway 1?
Yeah, you never seen Freeway?
No.
See, I want to do...
I don't know!
Oh my God, oh my God. You've never seen Freeway 1? Come on, everybody has like a movie here or there that they miss.
No, but this... I mean, here's the thing is, that's awesome. You get to experience it for the first time. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. It's like Reese Witherspoon in her edgy years.
See, that's the thing is I want to I'm trying to get my own podcast together because one of the episodes I want to do is when Reese Witherspoon had balls. Freeway and So Fucking What.
Oh my God, Freeway is such a great movie.
It is.
That's probably why I'm so butt sore about Freeway 2 is because Freeway 1's so amazing.
Freeway 1's amazing, but I don't know. See, I saw Freeway 2 first, so it's a fondness.
All right, well, those were all great final girls.
I like this little segment. This is fun.
Yeah, cool.
Do you have a next one in mind?
The first one I thought of was Haunted House movies, so I thought maybe we could do that
one
next.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe we can get our listeners to write in and tell us what your three examples of a haunted house movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's an idea.
Yeah. And people can write in and suggest, you know, ideas for future beginner's guides as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
Yeah. We like suggestions.
Cool.
All right.
Write to us.
Send us more emails that we won't read. I'm just kidding. We will. Okay. So cool. I guess that just leaves our recommendations, our Netflix/Love Films. Love Films? What is it?
Yeah.
Love Film recommendation/avoid.
Oh,
okay. Sound good?
Yeah, I don't have an avoid. I have a recommendation. And I won't spend too long on it because we are going long. And Sarah's mentioned it already a couple episodes ago. It's Mother's Day.
Yes.
Yeah.
The OG or the remake?
Oh, the remake. Yeah. directed by, is it Darren Boozman? Because you mentioned it, Rachel, when you were talking about 11.
Oh, 11, 11, 11. Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember that.
Yes.
11. You don't even, she's looking at me, she doesn't even remember. We watched it together. It was that terrible one that about the angels.
Oh, yeah.
The worst film of 2000, what was that?
11? I'm a little brain dead here, folks. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so I saw Mother's Day. I thought it was great because I was pretty intrigued to see it because it had Rebecca De Mornay in, because I've not seen her in many films lately.
That's true.
Yeah, and I just watched The Hand That Rocks the Cradle not long ago, rewatched that, which is wicked. And I think
I haven't seen that in ages.
Oh, it's so good. It really holds up. And I think we should do a, I don't know, like 80s and 90s women psycho killer retrospective show one day.
I think we need to do a motherhood horror.
Oh, yeah.
Where we could do Baby Blues. We could do The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. And there are a couple other ones that I can think of.
That's a good idea.
Maybe over a couple of episodes.
Yeah.
Well, we could do this one as well. I mean, I won't spend too much time on it. I just thought it was really good. I think Rebecca De Mornay is a really good sort of calm, sociopathic, you know, matriarchal, you know, nutter, and just really, really cool. There were some awesome kills as well. Yeah, some really good ones. But I do wonder if it had somebody else playing that character. I mean, we don't even learn her name. She's just Mother or Mama in the movie. If it had been somebody else, would I have even taken notice? Probably not. So I'd like to see it again to see how much it holds up and whether I was just, you know, watching it for the actress or not.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
But that is cool. On Love Film Instant. So people should check that out.
All right, UK listeners, consider yourself served. Awesome. And then Ariel is actually going to take over duties for I almost said the name of the movie, the Netflix pick for this month.
Okay. So normally when I watch Netflix movies, I end up watching crap horror, as I talked about earlier. But this time I actually picked this time I actually picked a good one. So the movie is called The Perfect Host. It came out in 2010. It stars David Hyde Pierce and the synopsis
from Frasier.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nigel.
You can just read the synopsis if you want.
Okay, so the synopsis, a fugitive on the lam decides to crash a dinner party, but he seriously regrets it when the mysterious and unusual host soon has him convinced that he would have been better off hiding somewhere else. David Hyde Pierce plays the memorable Warwick Wilson, Nathaniel Parker, blah, 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 a bunch of other people on it. Okay,
so... Also star.
Yeah. Okay, so... I really, really enjoyed this movie and was so glad that I watched it. David Hyde Pierce is amazing in it. I mean, I've never really seen him in very much outside of Frasier, and I didn't know how good he would be, but he was so compelling in this role and so
hilarious,
crazy and interesting that it just, like, it kept you watching. This movie has a lot of twists and turns. It goes in a lot of different directions, and you're not exactly sure what's going to happen next, who's crazy and who's sane, who's a bad guy and who's a good guy. And some people might get a little tired of that towards the end, but I really enjoyed it, and I think that
sounds
just
almost
for...
Hitchcockian.
Yeah, a little bit. And just for David Hyde Pierce's performance alone, I think it's worth it. I mean, you get to see him, like, basically, like, screwing a girl that doesn't exist. And he's, like, butt naked, you know. So there's, like, great scenes where he's just absolutely amazing and crazy. And he pulls it off really, really well. So I definitely recommend watching. I watched this movie and... before I go to bed every night, I tend to, like, watch a couple episodes of something, like, really lighthearted. Otherwise, my brain just goes crazy and I can't sleep. So I made the mistake of watching Frasier right after, and sort of, like, I was very, very sleepy and I kept kind of nodding off and then waking up. And right after seeing The Perfect Host and then watching Frasier, seeing him as Nigel, it was just very... disturbing and weird. Right. Anyways, I highly recommend this movie, especially to anybody that likes psychological thrillers, you know.
Cool.
Yeah.
And cat and mouse kind of stuff.
Sounds awesome. Good. This is actually one I haven't seen, so it's going on my queue. High five.
Good.
All right. And bringing in the terrible avoid it to save, you know, your life kind of bad Netflix options.
Okay. All right, I will be perfectly honest. I did not watch this entire movie. It's an anthology, and I was interested in it because it's George Romero's Dead Time Stories. It's available on Instant and on disc, and there's actually parts one and parts two,
mm-hmm.
but they're segments. The first segment, and it's the only one that I saw, is about a woman whose husband goes missing in the Amazon, and she goes to look for him, and it is boring. It is slow, and the CGI in it is so bad that remember that sci-fi movie Lair of the Tibetan Death Worm or whatever the hell it was? That movie is a cinematic fucking masterpiece compared to this piece of shit. And George Romero shows up and does this like horror host thing via like these like stacked up black and white TV sets, and it just like. Basically, he's just like reading a script for a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
It was bad, and just don't bother.
I've seen that one, the first volume of it.
Yeah,
I watched the whole thing.
I'm sorry.
No, I actually didn't hate it as much as you did. I'm a huge, huge fan of anthology movies, especially like. Ones from the 60s and 70s.
Oh,
and
I enjoy those, but I mean, like this ending one where they're like heads on a pike, and first of all, the CGI is just atrocious, and then it's like the woman's all happy, like, oh, honey, I get to spend eternity with you as a talking head on a pike.
Yeah. Anyways, so like I said, I have an affinity for these kind of anthology movies, and like the Trilogy of Terror ones. I adore those movies. And yes. I was hoping that this would be something along those same lines. And you're right. It's not great. I didn't hate it as much as you did, just because even if the different stories weren't necessarily like extremely well acted or great CGI or whatever, I still thought there were like some interesting ideas there. And sometimes that's enough for those kind of trilogy movies where they're shorts, you know?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of times those kind of anthologies have ideas that wouldn't necessarily work as like a feature length film, and it's a way to kind of see them done. But I agree with you that it's definitely not his best work, and it's definitely not the best anthology movie. Like, if I was going to introduce somebody to that subgenre of horror, this is not one I would put in the top, you know, 10. So
I see a future ZGBG.
However, I do want to make a side note and say that don't get this confused with another movie called Dead Time Stories from like 1986 that stars Scott Valentine in it, because that is actually a decent film, even though the DVD, it must have been filmed on somebody's handheld Super 8 when it originally came out, because the DVD transfer, it is grainy, it is awful. It's like watching somebody's home movies, but it's worth it if you can get past that. There's some really great little stories in there, especially there's a really great twist on Goldilocks and the Three Bears in that one. Mm. I highly recommend checking out that Dead Time Stories.
But not this one.
It's the ones that are streaming that are George Romero's Dead Time Stories to avoid.
All right. Bit of a dissenting opinion. I like it. Yeah. So spicy. All right, so I guess that's basically it. Is anybody else have any stuff they want to plug? No?
No.
Explody Files.
Listen
to Jody at Explody Files.
Listen to Explody Files. XR, awesome. Yeah.
It's a great and very entertaining show, so you really should check it out.
Oh.
All right, so thank you guys so much for joining us, and thank you everybody for listening. It's another long one. We appreciate you hanging in there with us.
Yeah, bye everyone.
Bye everyone. Bye. Mwah, mwah. Au revoir. Au revoir, Pee-wee.
I never would have pictured you for a furry.
I must have like latent furry tendencies, because I find these very exciting. And whenever I put them on, they're accompanied by a dance that I will not be demonstrating on.
Damn. I will. will catch
But there
you
is
one
a panda
days.
Pajama dance.
Cool.
Apparently I'm a secret exhibitionist as well. Oh, so are we recording? Is that saved for posterity, I hope?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Panda pajama dance.
The panda pajama dance. I like to kick the show off with something humiliating that I can throw into the outtakes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like drinking and smoking. They're like, they're best friends. Bert and Ernie. Do you want to separate Bert and Ernie? What kind of monster are you?
I only smoke occasionally. But it's like I can always tell when I've hit a certain stress level because most of the time cigarettes don't smell good to me, and when they start to smell good, so yeah. So
you smoke, Jody?
No, I don't. We were actually talking about this with Sarah on one of our Explodey files as well about smoking, and I mean I've had cigarettes in the past. I just haven't ever been a smoker, so I've never had to quit.
Yeah, me neither.
But every so often I just feel like I want one. I don't really know why, because I've never been addicted to cigarettes, but every so often I'm like, oh, you know what, I quite fancy, it's like I'm thirsty and I just feel like I need a drink, but I'm like, oh, you know what, I'm quite fancy a cigarette right now, but
oh,
I never give into it because I know how addictive it can be and how difficult it is to quit. So
can I just tell you?
Yes, but you can get black Russian cigarettes.
Quite fancy a cigarette.
I know, I love how you said that.
All right.
Yeah, but Jody, I want your voice.
Jody, you can get good cigarettes. You can get black Russian cigarettes.
What's that?
Oh, those are the ones that have the gold filter, right?
Yes.
Oh, those are amazing.
Oh, my God.
They quit importing them into the U.S. like 10 years ago, and you can get them online occasionally, but you spend like $60 for like a 10-pack.
Oh my God, we gotta stop talking about this. I'm having a problem. I really am. Like, my mouth is literally watering when we're talking about cigarettes. It's
okay.
Disgusting.
Do you have any other
hold on. I wanted to say one more thing because we're talking about smoking. Delicious, wonderful. And it reminded me of something else I wanted to ask Jody about.
Okay.
How did your interview with the smoking man go?
Oh, well, nice segue. Yeah. It was really good, actually. I was very nervous and very starstruck, and it was really weird because we did it over Skype and he had a webcam on. And
I said, good grief.
I can see you, and I wasn't expecting that. And he's just, I mean, I guess, like, because he plays a villain, obviously, and that's what he's probably most famous for playing. But he's just the sweetest, most benevolent, kind old man, and he's so kind and really nice and very funny. And yeah, it was really, really good. It'll be on an upcoming Explodey file at some point. I don't know when. I want to get it out quite soon.
Spoil it for you.
Oh, no, it's fine. No, it's fine. I've been, you know, putting out feelers to people to send me questions and stuff, so it's not going to be like a surprise reveal or anything. But
that'll be so much fun.
Hopefully it comes out all right. It was really nice, and I got him to say, "This is William B. Davis, and you're listening to the Explodey file." So that was really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, that really made my day. And he said I asked good questions, so that was cool as well.
Awesome.
And yeah, next I'm aiming for Skinner. I think he's roughly on the same sort of level, I think, so I might aim for him next.
Oh, coffee! You're my only friend. Oh,